Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff. This week on the show, the final Nintendo Direct for Super Smash Bros. Ultimate took place. We have a new disappointing episode of Doctor Who. We have more to talk about with Red Dead Redemption 2 and some other news, and that'll be an episode.
Yes. Yeah. It's another sort of grab-baggy episode as we ponder our way through this delirious, strange season of Doctor Who.
And a weird season for, like, very big video games that we cannot cover in one podcast.
God, no.
No. Yeah. Yeah, how far are you on Red Dead Redemption 2? Just so we can set a baseline for where we are today.
Yeah. Funny story about that. I am, like, 42% through the total completion.
Okay.
And I just started Chapter 3. So
Jesus.
I don't think I'm as far as you were when we talked last time in terms of the main story, but I have played a lot of that video game.
I'm at chapter 6, which is the final main chapter.
Okay, I've got a lot to play still.
And my understanding is there are post-game chapters, there's epilogues that I don't know what happens there, but like I am near where I assume credits are going to roll. And yeah, I'm curious. We'll get into it more later. We might have, I guess we're not going to have spoilers this time either because we really can't talk about this.
No, I've played maybe 7 story missions in the past week, but I've probably played like 15 to 20 hours.
So. I am so curious to hear about how you've been playing this game because I am much more mixed on the game this week than I was last week. Not like moving away from, I would recommend this game. I would recommend this game. I think it's an impressive game. Most of what I said last week still applies. But as I've moved through the story, a lot of the normal Rockstar chinks in the armor have started to rear their ugly head. And I'm curious to hear how you've been enjoying it on that other way, because I have not felt that pull to just go be in the world and ignore the story. So.
Yeah, and I'm the exact opposite. Like, I have felt almost no pull to do the main story stuff and have just been constantly pulled to the side to do, to hunt something or find some buried treasure or to help some random person or to shoot some random person and just, like, have been having wacky adventures throughout the Wild West that way.
Weird. See, this sounds like we're playing two completely separate games. So yeah. I am curious to talk about that. We will get to that later after we do the news. The news will include the Nintendo Direct from this week, which I had a lot of fun with. People were disappointed because it did not live up to an absolutely ridiculous leak that the internet's stupidest people fell for. If you were not under the impression that Sakurai was going to announce 15 new characters, including Geno from Super Mario RPG, this was a good Nintendo Direct. If you were under the impression that a game that already had 70 announced fighters had 15 more to go, I don't know what to tell you, but I've got a hell of a bridge to sell you.
Yeah. And if you, like me, were holding on to that vain, impossible hope that Goku would finally be in Super Smash Bros., it is maybe time to give up that dream. Because they had a video that would have been the perfect time to just have fucking Goku pop in and take care of some shit. And Goku didn't pop in and everybody died. And that's what happens when you don't put Goku in your game, is everyone gets fucking killed.
I guess so.
Goku in that bitch.
There's a whole season of DLC to come, though, Sean. So who knows?
It's true.
Who knows? All right, we'll get to all of that later, including this week's Doctor Who, which, quick spoiler-free reaction.
Stuff happened. You know, there was a ship. Yeah. A guy gave birth. And that's it. Yeah, there we go. I think that's the episode of Doctor Who.
It was technically an episode of Doctor Who. It started and it said Doctor Who. Didn't much feel like Doctor Who, but it was technically Doctor Who.
There was no point in this episode of Doctor Who where there was some sort of strange break in morality, and I appreciated that. There was no moment where the Doctor, like, very brutally killed something in a way that did not use a gun and was very contemptuous of other people using guns. And so that was an improvement.
I was expecting it to happen because there's a moment where it seemed like she was about to blow something up and she didn't. I was impressed by that.
Yeah.
So that's the low bar we're at right now on Doctor Who. So we'll get there later. For now, let's do some stuff, Sean. First on my stuff outline is vote. For the love of all that is good in this world, please, if you are in the United States, vote. I have demographic data. I know we have a lot of international listeners. We love you. This part is not for you. You cannot vote in our elections. But if you are a listener here in the United States and you are able to vote and you do not vote, you are a selfish piece of shit. That's all there is to it. You have this little bit of power, and if enough people exercise that little bit of power, it's a lot of power. And you should go do it, because it's really easy, and it's really, really fucking important. And I'm really stressed out about it, and we're not talking about that today. But that is this week. No. This is our Monday podcast. Tomorrow is your last day. You go vote. I think it's like 27 states have day of registration. You can go do it. You're fine. You can do it. You can vote. Please go vote. It's really important.
Yes.
I have voted, Sean.
I echo all of that. Yes, I have voted. And I had an idea earlier today when I was watching a YouTube video of how we could make people vote more, or at least young people, is if instead of them giving you a dumb sticker or button or whatever, they should just give you a little code that you can type into YouTube that exempts you from any political advertisements. And just, like, you don't see any just, like, random, like, I've seen so many of the same fucking ads for just, like, random shit. Half of them are, like, people that I hate that I'm definitely not going to vote for that I'm just subjected to when I want to watch a dumb video on my fucking PlayStation on YouTube. And if I just could put a code into YouTube that says I did this shit, it is, like, impossible for me to do anything now. You cannot sway my vote because I already voted. Please stop showing me this bullcrap. Please stop. That's what I want.
I have YouTube Red, so I totally forget that YouTube runs advertisements. But now that you remind me of that, I remember, like, 4 years ago, before there was YouTube Red,
yeah,
and there were election ads, and I'm thinking that's a great idea, Sean, that you could get that. I think they could give you, like, an Instagram filter or something. Instead of, like, an I voted sticker, just give you an I voted Instagram filter. People would use that way more. You know, some people never go on Instagram without the fucking, like, dog ears and shit. So just do that. Just do
that. Yeah, give just some hot piece of Fortnite flair for people who voted. There you go. I guess probably most of the people who play Fortnite can't vote yet, but it gets them in early. Like, gets them thinking about it, gets them jealous.
I think Fortnite should have a voter registration thing built in, where if you play Fortnite, you get registered to vote when you're 18. We would think of how legitimately what a boost that would be to the electorate.
Yes. See, this is the problem with our democracy. There's no creativity in it anymore.
No, there is not. But, look, guys, serious talk here. Voting is really important. Sean and I, you know, I'm 26. You're going to be 26 soon. I have voted in every election I've been eligible to vote in.
Yep.
And it's not because I'm a hero. It's because it's easy, and I feel a responsibility to do it, and it's important. My first election I voted in was 2010. You were not old enough yet, Sean. I was. It was because we have that weird one-month difference we have.
Yeah.
And I was the only Democrat who voted in the entire Midwest in 2010, I think is how that worked. And I felt very lonely. You don't have to make everyone lonely. Go vote. It's very important. And I don't know what else to say. All the podcasts are telling you to vote. I think we should tell you to vote, too. You know, if we have to bribe you or something, fuck it. I'll send you $10. Actually, I think that's illegal. Ignore that. But, you know, we'll sing a song on the podcast if that's what will get you out to the polls. I don't know.
Sure, fuck it.
You have to vote Democrat for that.
It's
all right. But anyway, that is my plea. Please, for the love of God, especially if any of y'all are in, you know, swing states and stuff, that's important. So let's see. What's up next, Sean? You wanted to talk about a video game.
Yes, there was a thing I forgot to talk about last week on the podcast because we got swept up in the afterglow of Red Dead Redemption 2 and you know, that fucking really weird episode of Doctor Who we had last week with the American shit and the spiders. And I just kind of forgot to mention that I felt our spider quota was covered in last week's episode because I had played The Heist, the first DLC for Marvel Spider-Man on the PlayStation 4, which I played basically in one sitting last week before Red Dead Redemption 2 came out. There was basically 2 days between me finishing Dragon Quest XI and getting Red Dead Redemption 2. I spent one of those days blissfully not playing any video games at all, and it was a beautiful time in my life that I haven't had in a while. And then I spent another one of those days playing The Heist, and it's pretty interesting. The first thing I want to note up front Because it was something that I was kind of surprised about with this, is because I wasn't expecting this with the DLC, is that this is not totally standalone in the sense of they're releasing three DLCs, and it seems like those are all one story. It's not, the heist is a story, then the next one, I think called Turf Wars or whatever, that's going to be its own story, and the third one is going to be its own story. This DLC, the story missions for this DLC ends with a straight up to be continued screen and like a cliffhanger. So my recommendation is, if you are interested in playing more Marvel Spider-Man and want the DLC, wait for all of them to be done, because that just feels like will be the best way to consume this. But other than that, I really enjoyed it. It's pretty brief. It's like 2 to 3 hours, maybe 4, if you do absolutely everything in the DLC. And basically what they do is you go into a menu once you've loaded up your file and you're like in the open world, and they've added an option into your options menu that is basically like select a campaign you want to play, and that's where how you access your DLC. And so it loads you into basically a separate instance of New York City that gets rid of a bunch of the normal stuff that's on your map. That's like, you know, all the random like enemy bases, most of the random crimes don't appear. The stuff that does carry over, I think, are your landmark collectibles and your backpack collectibles. So if you've been playing the main game and you load up the heist DLC, I'm guessing that those carry over because I had all those unlocked, but they still kind of popped up on the map of like, oh, hey, you have all the backpacks discovered in this area. So I'm guessing you can kind of jump between the two different ones and still get those collectibles if you're interested in doing that. But otherwise, it's pretty completely separate. And so what they do with that is they kind of clear out a bunch of the clutter on your map, and instead they have a series of what is probably like 4 main story missions. I don't remember exactly how many, probably 4 or 5. And then they add some new challenge type missions that are sort of like the Taskmaster ones. They're a bit special and they're a bit different. They use the Screwball character who was in the main campaign very briefly in Marvel Spider-Man. And then there's also another set of collectibles, which are these paintings you can find. They're all related to the Black Cat. And then they also add in some new random crimes. If you want to do the 100% stuff, you have to do that involve the Magia, which is the Marvel version of the Mafia, because, you know, those comics were made in the 60s and 70s and they didn't want the actual Mafia rolling up on Marvel Comics and being like, hey, what the fuck are you doing? So they called them the Magia. And it's pretty cool because it is this little tiny microcosm of the game that can be cleared in a couple of hours, but it kind of gives you every little facet of what the full game was, but in much more sort of bite-sized digestible format. But the real star of the story is Felicia Hardy, the Black Cat, who comes in, who they kind of teased in the main campaign. And her story and her relationship with Peter and how that goes, even though it's only a couple of hours and a couple of missions, is really compelling. And it's very representative of the kind of stuff they did in the main story, which is it takes a lot of things that if you're familiar with Spider-Man, that you know in different kind of characters and storylines and some broad sort of relationship beats and dynamics that you know already, but they play with it and twist it in different ways. And I don't want to spoil anything, but the sort of the end they get into of like how Peter kind of gets wrapped up in Black Cat's business again and how that unfolds, and then like how that sort of throws this wrench in his relationship with Mary Jane because she's very present in the DLC as well. That's really compelling and interesting. And then there is also stuff very briefly only over the radio, but there is some stuff with Miles in the game that does address sort of the post game of Spider-Man's world. And so I think I read somewhere that if you haven't finished the main campaign when you load in the heist, that maybe some of those more spoilery things will not pop up and it'll be a bit more ambiguous where in the timeline it takes place. But the way I played it felt very definitively, this is after the events of Marvel Spider-Man, and Peter's relationships with the people in his life are at a couple of weeks or something after the end credits of Spider-Man. So it's a really cool way to kind of like pick up the story again, to sort of visit these characters, play around with the mechanics. I really enjoyed the challenge maps, and there's some good swinging challenges in there that I got gold on all of those. And then there's also 3 new suits that you can unlock by doing everything. And they're pretty good. One of them that I don't love so much is a new original suit they made for it, but the other two are awesome. One of them being the Scarlet Spider suit worn by Kane. In the more modern Scarlet Spider series, which is this like really nice kind of two-tone red and black suit that looks really cool. But the star suit you unlock, that you can obviously, you can bring all of these once you unlock them into the main game, and I assume the later DLCs as well, is Spider-Man UK, which is basically Spider-Man's costume if it was the United Kingdom's flag. And it's fucking great. And it's goofy and it's dumb, but I really love how it looks. And that's how I kind of cleaned up all the challenges, was just arriving, swinging around New York City with the fucking Union Jack on Spider-Man. And it looked fucking dope.
I thought you were going to say he had like one of the like Buckingham Palace guard uniforms on and one of those big, stupid, fluffy hats.
That would be pretty good also. I think that would be a little bit inconvenient to fight crime in, but that would have been a good option. But yeah, so yeah, I would say hold off on the DLC if you're interested until all of them are out. But if you did buy like a version of the game like I did that just came with all that stuff, it is kind of cool to be able to sort of play it. I know that, you know, it's, I mean, less than a month now until the next one comes out, and a month after that the last one will come out. And so there's something nice about having this, like, honestly, like, very comic book sized story told that's like, I could very, very easily see the story told in this DLC being one or two issues of a comic book that like ends on a cliffhanger and you have to wait to pick up the next one. But I would probably say that for most people, you would just want to wait for what is, if all three of the DLCs are the same size as this one, what will probably be a good like 10 to 12 hours of additional content with a really good story. Again, Black Cat and the way they play her, and the actress that does her voice, and then the music, the theme they have for the Black Cat is awesome. All that stuff is so great and is like of the quality that you expect from the main game. And so that's the real attraction here. But it is definitely not a very sizable offering that people need to jump in immediately.
Awesome. Yeah, I've been wondering about that. I had not gotten it yet just because, A, there were too many fucking games out right now.
Yeah.
And B, I kind of didn't want to spend the money until I heard from you or some other critic I trusted. I kind of feel like they maybe made a mistake releasing it at this time because nobody covered this DLC online, as far as I could tell. Like, that is the most detailed review I have heard of this DLC. So, you know, maybe not so quick after the main game would have been better. Like, this feels like something that maybe should have started, I don't know, in December or something to me, just to give us more distance. Because that's the other thing. It's like, I feel like I just played Marvel's Spider-Man, and I love that game, but I also feel like I got my fill of it. So I feel like if I wait a couple of months, maybe even the season pass will go on sale at some point, and I can play it, and it'll be like Spider-Man 1.5, and I can just have fun with that, and it'll be far enough away that it'll feel nice and fresh. But yeah, I'm glad to hear that it's good. And I was curious how they were handling the three DLCs things, and how many like points of crossover there would be. So that's interesting.
Yeah. It definitely feels like to me that because I do like having the DLC be kind of closer to the game's release, because you end up with a situation like Horizon Zero Dawn from last year, where the DLC came out like 7, 8, 9 months later from the main game's release. And by that time, I was like, I have to basically like fully recommit myself to playing this game because I've forgotten most of how to play it at this point. I mean, like, it would take a lot to get me into, and so I never ended up playing that DLC because it just felt too far away. The problem with this one is that it's like right in the middle of fall, and so it's like there's so many new games like Red Dead Redemption 2. Hitman 2 comes out distressingly soon to me, with the pace that I'm playing Red Dead Redemption 2 right now. And so yeah, it's going to be hard to find time to play the Spider-Man DLC, whereas if this strategy was executed like over the summer months and it was like one that came out in June, July, and then August,
that would make
that
sense.
That would be a great release strategy. But having it be fucking October, November, December, the three busiest months for video games, is a lot.
Sean, I have to say, just on a total tangent, I have no idea when I'm playing Hitman 2. I know I want to play it. I want to play it badly, but it is coming out like the week that Thanksgiving break starts, which in theory would be a great time to play it, except I'm going to be heading out of town, and I'm probably not going to take my PlayStation with me, and I'm probably going to take my Switch with me and play the new Pokemon game, because I'll have it on the go as I go home to Colorado. So, I mean, we'll see each other then, but like, I'm probably not going to play Hitman 2 right away. Maybe I'll play it when I get back, but then Smash Bros. Comes out, it's like, there's just too many games, and Hitman is one I really want to sink my teeth into. So it's stressful. Games need to be spread out more. This is silly.
Yeah, no, it's especially silly because it felt like, a couple of months ago, when I was looking at the schedule, I was looking at it as like, oh, there's a lot of time to play all these games. And then I ended up playing Dragon Quest XI without, like, really planning ahead of time that that was something that I really wanted to do. And that just kind of was thrust upon me all of a sudden. It was like, oh, shit, I guess I'm playing Dragon Quest XI now. And then, yeah, I'm spending so much time playing Red Dead Redemption 2. I was like, oh, yeah, like 2 to 3 weeks. It's like 2.5 weeks or something distance between Red Dead Redemption 2 and Hitman 2's release, because Red Dead came out on like a Friday, Hitman's coming out on a Tuesday. It's just like, that will be more than enough time, and now I'm looking at it, it's like, I just started Chapter 3. This is not enough time.
I mean, Sean, the length you're playing that game at, that's 100 hours, I would bet. Mm-hmm. If you continue playing at that pace, I doubt you will continue playing at that exact pace, because you will run out of things to do.
Yeah, but it definitely feels like the story, I'm going to have to kick along the story faster, because I've very much exhausted everything in kind of like the first areas you go to, and I'm excited to kick into the newer areas I'm riding into right now, but I feel like kind of exhausted of what is maybe half of the map of that game.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a big game. I mean, Sean, you said you've played maybe 7 missions in the last week?
Yes.
I've played over 70. This is...
Shit.
If you did 7 missions a week, it would take you 10 weeks to get to where I am.
Yeah,
and I'm not
that's
done.
That's 2.5 months.
And I believe there's over 100 in the game. I don't know what the final count is, but I think I saw that cited somewhere. So,
to be fair, most of those 7 missions were played in one day. I spent several days playing that game where I did literally no story missions.
Yeah.
I almost didn't get to Chapter 3 today. I had to force myself to play the story mission because I'm like, I have to get to Chapter 3. I can't still be on Chapter 2 the next time we play about this fucking video game.
All right. Well, we will talk more about Red Dead 2 in a little bit. Sean, my piece of stuff this week is I got up off the couch and went and saw a picture show last night, as they are wont to call them now. No, I don't know. No, I went to see a movie.
You watched one of those newfangled talkies, didn't you?
One of those newfangled talkies. I went to see Luca Guadagnino's Suspiria. This is the remake of the 1977 Dario Argento film. I will say, I have not seen the Dario Argento film. You can all yell at me on Twitter. I will see it at one point. That does, you know, unless I die tomorrow, this does not mean I will never see the movie. I do plan on seeing it, but I have not seen it. So I went in very cold to this one. I do have my understanding from reading other people's reactions who have seen the Argento film is that this has very little to do with it other than kind of the basic premise. It very much takes it in a different aesthetic, narrative, stylistic direction, which I think is good. That's what you should do with a remake, especially of a beloved classic like Suspiria. So it's a remake, but I don't think you have to worry about it in that way. But yes, I went to go see Suspiria, the new film. I was attracted to it for a couple of reasons, because it looked weird and crazy, and it's about dance, and there is a subgenre of movies that go fucking crazy with people in dance troupes, like The Red Shoes and Black Swan and things like that, and it is one of my favorite weird subgenres in the history of cinema, and Suspiria looked like a good solid entry in that, and I was also a big fan of Guadagnino's last film, Call Me By Your Name. And I have to say, Call Me By Your Name, which was made last year, and Suspiria, made this year, that is probably the boldest statement of directorial range I have ever seen someone make, doing those two films back-to-back in 2 years. Because Call Me By Your Name is this, you know, very kind of, like, slow but warm movie about love and desire, and it is, like, visually beautiful, and it is so, like, human and direct, and Suspiria is cold and crazy and one of the absolute most, like, viscerally affecting films I've ever seen. I love this movie. I don't really even know what to say about it, though, because I'm still running through it in my head. It's 2.5 hours long, and I liked the length of it. Some people have complained about that. I think it justifies its length very well. And it's just like this long, slow, warm bath of terror, and I don't know if that goes together, but that is kind of what it felt like, because it was both absolutely horrifying and also kind of weirdly comforting, and it was this crazy communal experience too, because I'm in this small theater here in Iowa City called Film Scene, which is the only place this movie was showing, and there were just multiple prolonged sequences in this film where people throughout the theater were audibly saying, Jesus Christ, or, oh my God, or gasping at what was going on screen. And it was kind of an incredible communal experience that way. I know my jaw was just kind of dropped for most of it. It is an out there movie. It is an unabashedly and I think very interestingly feminist movie, because pretty much every figure on screen for the entire film is a woman. It is a movie about relationships between women. It is about witches doing some real-ass witchcraft, not like Sabrina the Teenage Witch, like she's got a fun cat and everything. I don't know about the new Sabrina. I just mean, like, you know, it's not like fun witch. It's not Kiki's Delivery Service. It's nothing like that. It's, you know, like blood sacrifice rituals and shit. And there's all these sequences where they do spells through, like, weird experimental dance. And it's crazy, and the editing in this movie is one of the most just viscerally upsetting deployments of editing I have ever seen. Sean, this connection will make no sense to most of our listeners, but I know it'll make sense to you. You know the King Who film I recommended to you, Legend of the Mountain?
Yes.
You know that great scene with the drums where they're having the drum fight from a distance and the editing is drawing them together?
Yes.
There's a scene like that with dance and body horror in this movie, and it is extremely upsetting, and I will never forget what I saw in that theater because it hurt me.
That sounds pretty fucking good.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty good.
So, I think it's a masterful film. As I said, the editing, the cinematography by a Thai cinematographer whose name I'm not going to try to say off the top of my head, but also has done work with Apichat Pong, We're All Set the Cool on, like, Uncle Boon Me and things like that. He also did Guadagnino's last film. And it's amazing cinematography work. I think the music, which is by the guy from Radiohead, is a very, very cool score and also just very chilling. I think it builds to an absolutely amazing climax and a kind of weirdly touching ending. If you have a chance to go see this movie, go see it. Go in cold, unless you have a, like, very strong aversion to graphic violence. You might want to, like, look this up and see if it is your speed, because it's really heavy. Like, the last movie I saw in a theater that made me feel like I needed a shower this badly was the Evil Dead remake.
Oh,
just
yeah.
If we're going by the number of buckets of fake blood on screen. So, there you go. But I would highly recommend this. I'm kind of disappointed. It does not look like it's going into wide release. It's a fairly limited release at this point. It's in, like, 300 theaters. I'm sure one of the theaters we have in Denver has it, because Denver always gets limited release movies. But if you can see it, you should go see it. And Sean, I implored you this off the air. I will implore you on the air. If you have the time to go see Suspiria, I just need to talk to someone about it. It's one of those cases. So
I will definitely make the effort now. Like,
yeah.
Like you saying that scene from Legend of the Mountain, but with, like, body horror, that immediately, that's like, okay, that sounds like a movie I should go watch.
You will know the scene, and you will know why I made that connection. Because, yeah, it's a thing. And now I'm excited to go watch the original Argento film, and I kind of want to go see this movie again, but I don't know if I can, like, put my body through the experience of watching it. It's quite a thing, and I have to say, you know, we don't cover new movies on here quite as much because you don't see them as much, and I don't see them as much as I used to. This has been a great year for film, just an amazing year. I don't think I even talked about A Star Is Born on here, which I absolutely loved. I loved First Man. I loved this. We've had great movies all year. I think 2018 is the best year for film in quite a long time. Probably I would go to 2014 was the last comparable year. But and before that, maybe 10 or 11. But, like, this is a really great year for film, and I'm excited to. This is one year where I feel like I'm not even going to have to, like, work that hard on catching up to make a top 10 list, because I already could put a pretty good one together. This is a strong year for movies. So, yeah.
Awesome.
All right. Let's go ahead and move on and do some news, Sean.
What's going on in the news, Jonathan?
First, Red Dead Redemption 2 sold an absolutely unholy amount of copies. In its first 3 days in release, it did $725 million worth of sell-through. That is the second biggest entertainment launch of all time, behind GTA V, which did $1 billion worth of sell-through. For reference, the biggest opening weekend of all time is Star Wars The Force Awakens with, like, $260 million. So Red Dead did more than double that in 3 days. $725 million would translate to roughly 10 million copies moved in 3 days. Sean, I don't know what crazy monkey's paw Rockstar made a wish on, but it is paying dividends because they make too much money.
Yeah, they make too much money, but at least I like that they made too much money on a game that is, like, really fucking weird. Because Red Dead Redemption 2 is a weird fucking video game.
It is,
it's not
yeah.
like, you know, GTA 5 is a weird game, but in a very traditional way, in particularly for its time. It's like, it's, you know, their design sense has always been a little bit, like, idiosyncratic. But Red Dead Redemption 2 just feels like Rockstar, like, made infinite money on Grand Theft Auto 5 and spent a lot of time and a lot of people and, you know, maybe violated some common work ethic practices and a lot of common work ethic practices in getting this game made. But they did it in service of, like, a especially idiosyncratic, like, unconventional vision for a video game that I've never seen another game pursue. So I'm curious to find out, like, a couple of months from now how many of those 10 million or so copies are ones that people, like, really into what the game was and how much is, like... I'm curious if this game is going to have, like, a bigger rejection after the fact than, like, GTA 5, which, you know, the critical reception to that game was sort of... lukewarm, like a week or two afterwards of like people stopping and more considering that game, and then but then the rest of the larger population just took that game and ran with it and never looked back. I'm curious to see if maybe Red Dead 2 is almost going to be flipped and it's going to be the critical reception is going to be very positive further out, and the larger communal reception of that game is going to be more, what the fuck is this game actually? Why is this a video game where you have to stop and spend 5 seconds skinning a fucking bear and you can only put one skin on your horse?
5 seconds is lowballing that. But yes, I'm super curious about that too, Sean. It's a question I've wanted to ask because I do think I think that the X factor for me on this is how Red Dead Online does and what the hell mm-hmm. that even is, because that's the thing that kept GTA 5 going so much, I think, because it was so... I mean, no one talks about the GTA 5 campaign because there was nothing to talk about there. It was garbage, but it had this nice world that they were able to translate into this very lucrative online thing, and I would bet, and I'm sure there's research to back this up, that that is what has kept sales going as long as they've gone for GTA 5. I mean, just the fact that they sell, like, the GTA 5 cash with, like, every purchase of that game, and, like, yeah. you got it if you pre-ordered Red Dead Redemption 2 on the PS stores, you got, like, $1 million of GTA 5 cash. Like, I think that's where it's going. I can't really imagine, unless Red Dead Online is really radically different from the main game, it having that kind of shelf life. Not because it's not a good game, but because, as you say, this is an idiosyncratic, weird game that it does not feel like it's pitched at the same kind of broad audience that Grand Theft Auto games are, or even maybe Red Dead 1 was. Like, this is a very different kind of audience I feel like they're going for, and I am just super curious. I've already kind of seen that out in the ether, that it feels like the general reception is a lot more mixed because I think people seem kind of confused by what the game is doing. I'm confused by some of the things the game is doing. It's hard to reconcile. And I am curious where this game goes. Like, clearly it's going to turn a massive profit, and I don't think it's going to be looked back on as any sort of, like, financial disappointment for the studio.
No.
And if it is, their next game is GTA 6. So, like, you know, fuck it. They're going to make another game where you go kill strippers and they're going to make billions of dollars. So who knows? I have no idea what an online mode for this game really is, and I'm very curious what happens with that, you know?
Yeah, at the very least, I find it, like, I do not find it possible that they would, like, sell hover horses or, like, you know, because, like, GTA 5 and GTA Online just got weird, and they have, like, the DeLorean and shit in that game and hover bikes, and, like, they you know, the DLC went full Grand Theft Auto San Andreas and stuff. I think literally they have jetpacks in it at this point. And there's just not as much room in Red Dead 2 to do that kind of stuff without completely breaking the sense of the world. And yes, like, advanced technology breaks the sense of the world in GTA 5 also, but it's a much thinner break because GTA 5 is ridiculous. Whereas, like, Red Dead 2 is so grounded, and again, it is about, like, you, like, huddling over a campfire in the middle of the woods eating a fucking can of beans before you go and kill a coyote to skin it and sell it to a trapper so he can make you a cool hat. You know, it's, like, a very different kind of world.
Yes. So, more Red Dead talk later, but that is the sales news on it. I was curious how it was going to do, because I was wondering how much of the GTA 5 effect was going to carry over to Red Dead 2, because I think people forget, but, like, even at the time, GTA 5 sales were insane. Nothing Rockstar had put out. I mean, no video game had ever done numbers like that. So it was kind of like, is that going to be a universal thing for Rockstar now or just for GTA? and this is less than GTA 5, but it's so close that it's like, it seems like this is just how Rockstar's games sell right now, you know?
Yeah.
And I, you know, it happens if you only make a game once every 5 years, which you can
longer
do
than that now. Which,
yeah, well, but that's something you can do if your game makes $6 billion in revenue, which is what GTA 5 did. They had $6 billion to go on, so yes, they could go 5 years without a release. It's crazy. So, all right, next piece of news. The PlayStation Classic, Sony's ripoff of the Super NES Classic, had its full lineup announced this week, and I think we're all pretty sure Sony has played a practical joke on everyone, because let's go through the lineup here, Sean. It's okay. Terrible. It has one bright spot to me, and we'll cheer for it when we get there. But these are the games. Battle Arena Toshinden, Cool Borders 2, Destruction Derby, Final Fantasy VII, that's the first game I've heard of on this list, Grand Theft Auto 1, the Grand Theft Auto no one knows about, Intelligent Cube, spelled with a Q, Jumping Flash, exclamation point, Metal Gear Solid, good, that would be weird if that wasn't there, Mr. Driller, Oddworld Abe's Odyssey, Rayman, Resident Evil Director's Cut, Revelations Persona, okay, good
yay.
On you, good on you, PlayStation Classic, that was a good cut, Ridge Racer Type 4, Super Puzzle Fighter 2 Turbo, Siphon Filter, Tekken 3, Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six, Twisted Metal, and Wild Arms. All right, it got Persona, it got Metal Gear, that's pretty much it. We have no Symphony of the Night, no Crash Bandicoot, no Spyro, no Resident Evil 2, no Tomb Raider. What the hell is this thing, Sean?
Yeah, I'm not as mystified about it as you. It's just the sense of, like, some of, like, it's... I feel like that list makes some things very clear. Of one, they are very heavily preferring the first game in a series, and so they have Resident Evil over Resident Evil 2, they have Twisted Metal over Twisted Metal 2, there was another one on here that was like Grand Theft Auto 1 over Grand Theft Auto 2, all those games being like, people generally regard the sequels as being better than the original, but they're like, we'll put the first one on there. Where they broke that was with like Tekken 3, and Ridge Racer, I don't remember, I had to have no knowledge of which Ridge Racers are which Ridge Racers at any point in time. So I don't know if that was the first one on the PlayStation. That could be the last one on the PlayStation. Who knows? But then the other thing is that there are a lot of games that it's clear that I'm assuming that Sony wanted to have on there and didn't because... like Symphony of the Night just got a re-release on PS4, like bundled with Rondo of Blood. That just happened like a week or two ago. Crash Bandicoot is Activision, and they did that remastered thing. I don't remember who owns Spyro, but there's a Spyro remastered thing that's just coming out. Tomb Raider's a little bit inexplicable. I don't know why Tomb Raider's not on there. Like, although Sony doesn't own Tomb Raider, so it's entirely possible that that just didn't work out. Stuff like Gran Turismo has a bunch of car licensing, so the licensing thing probably presented that. Tony Hawk's Pro Skater and Pro Skater 2, which are two of the big PS1 games, both of those have a tremendous amount of licensed music in it, so that's probably why not. And so it seems like that's some of the stuff that prevented some of those games being on there. But yeah, it's a strange list. There's some
but
of these
the,
that...
I guess my okay. point, though, is like I get the explanations for why things aren't on here. Why make it if you couldn't get... like? If Nintendo, for whatever reason, couldn't put A Link to the Past on the Super NES Classic, why would they make a Super NES Classic? That's doing this without Symphony of the Night.
Yeah, but, like, part of this is the PS1 has such a really broad library of games that some of the, like, a lot of these are games that I have heard of and know are held in high regard, like an Intelligent Cube, IQ, which is a puzzle game, or Jumping Flash. I never understood why people like that game, but people like Jumping Flash for whatever reason. This is sacrilegious on this podcast, but the game here that stands out the most is, like, why is this game on here, is Revelations Persona. Because all of these other games are games that were, like, well-regarded and liked in their day.
Yeah.
Revelations Persona is only on here because Persona 5 sold like 2 million copies,
yes.
Right? It's and so because also Revelations Persona is weird because that's the original PS1 version, which I assume is just going to have the original PS1 localization, which is like they changed place names, they changed character names, they changed the ethnicities of specific characters all to like Americanize the game. And so unless they're going back and redoing work on that, which
they're not.
They're definitely not doing. That's kind of like a weird a weird one to go back to compared to the if anyone wants to play the original Persona, I would recommend playing the PSP remake, which you can play obviously on the PSP, or you can play on the Vita, which is how I played it. But the other ones of these, like, you know, Siphon Filter this is hard for me because I am not a big PlayStation 1 guy. I know that, Jonathan, you were not a big PlayStation 1 guy. We were both too young at that point, and, like, both of us, our families, like, were more in the Nintendo, and most of my friends were more N64, but I had a couple of PlayStation 1 guys. So stuff like Tekken 3 interests me. I was never that into Twisted Metal, but people really love Twisted Metal. People love Siphon Filter. People love Ridge Racer. People love Rayman, even though the old Rayman games I really don't like. So yeah, it's a weird list. It's not a utterly perplexing list to me, but it is frustrating to be like there's definitely a much better list of 20 PlayStation games that could be made without restrictions.
Yeah, and it's just, I just don't quite know why they're doing it this way, because I bet they could have announced this list of 20 games 3 weeks ago when they announced the system. They didn't. They waited until they sold through all the pre-orders and you couldn't get it anymore, and then they told people what's actually on it. And the most frequent comment I saw was people canceling their pre-orders because it's like, well, now that I know what's on there, I don't want that. Because I think even if in the generous view of this list, I'm not sure what individual fan this service is. Like, it's broad, I guess, but... And the PlayStation 1 did have a broad audience. I do think, like... Especially, as you said, I mean, there are restrictions, but let's put those aside for a second. You probably could have made a solid, like, hits collection here, you know, whatever the equivalent would be to, like, a Super NES or NES Classic, where it's like, you know, not everything is on there, but I look at that, and that is a solid 70% of what I would expect to be on this thing, or something like that. And that's not what they did. Again, like, now that we've seen the full list, the holding it back until all the pre-orders sold out thing seems extra skeevy to me. And selling this thing for $100 with that list of games and with the shittier version of the controllers that don't have the sticks, so they couldn't do things like Monkey Ball. I don't know. It's a weird thing.
The one thing I will say is the one game on this list that jumps out at me is, like, I do actually really want to play this game is Super Puzzle Fighter 2 Turbo. Like, go look up YouTube videos of Super Puzzle Fighter because that game looks fucking awesome. And I've always wanted to play, but it's not particularly easy to play these days.
Huh.
So that's a cool get for me. That's like, you know, I'm not going to get this. I didn't get an NES Classic. I didn't get a Super Nintendo Classic. There's basically no version of this console I would get unless I were able to pick individually the 20 games myself, which is obviously impossible. So, but that's like Super Puzzle Fighter 2 Turbo. I would like to play that game.
All right. Well, maybe I'll get it for you for Christmas, Sean.
Sure.
Not really. If I were going to spend $100 on you, I don't know. I'd get you
there's a better $100 to be spent than a thing that I just kind of want to play Super Puzzle Fighter 2 Turbo, and maybe I'd check out some Tekken because I liked that when I was a kid.
Sean, I would buy you a second copy of the Zatoichi Criterion set as a backup in case anything happens to your first Zatoichi set.
That would be appreciated. You know, that way I can have one that I watch and one I keep in the safe.
Yes, exactly. All right, so last piece of news this week is our big piece of news, which is Masahiro Sakurai and the good people at Nintendo gave us our final Smash Direct, Nintendo Direct for Super Smash Bros. Ultimate. This is the last one before launch. It was pretty jam-packed. As I said before, let's recap the situation, Sean, really quick. We did not cover this on the podcast because it was stupid, but a very obvious fake leak came out a couple weeks ago, and it put the internet in a tizzy trying to figure out if it was real or not. It was not real. It was pretty... to my eyes, it was very obviously not real, just having been someone who's followed Nintendo long enough and has a pretty good sensor for, like, when something's going to be real or not. And this was not. But it had, like, all these things on it, like we were going to get... The big two were Geno from Mario RPG and... Was it Crash Bandicoot? Banjo-Kazooie. Yeah, Banjo-Kazooie. Sorry, Crash Bandicoot is PS1, as we just talked about. Yeah. Banjo-Kazooie seemed like something that could happen. Nintendo and Microsoft are buddy-buddy now, and Microsoft technically owns Banjo. But, like that, it was those two. It was every Echo Fighter everyone wanted, like Shadow the Hedgehog. It was like at least 7 or 8 new characters when Sakurai himself had told us several times, like, we're not going to have 15 more new characters. Like, I've already given you 70. How much do you people want? Was the subtext of his, like, you know, very exhausted responses in interviews and stuff. So people went into it expecting all of that, and I think there was some disappointment largely stemming from the leak. And then also, I think they made some weird choices on which two characters they held back for this final direct. Other than that, though, I think if you took this at face value, there was a lot of cool stuff in here. The main announcements about all the single-player stuff, like Spirits Mode and the World of Light Adventure and the insane cutscene they showed off, was a lot of fun. And once again, I'm just insanely excited for this game. So, Sean, let's go through the announcements that were here.
Okay.
So, Sean...
Yeah, I just want to note for the listener that Jonathan has made incredibly extensive notes, like me doing E3 yes. level of notes for this one Nintendo Direct. And I watched probably about 10 minutes, maybe. I definitely watched the crazy video at the end. I watched the introduction of Ken, because I like Ken. Ken is cool. And I kind of got swept up in Incineroar because he's in the same video, but whatever. And I think that's all I watched from this.
Okay. So this is like the one thing, not a Nintendo Direct, but a Smash Brothers Nintendo Direct is the one thing that will make me take notes on a video game announcement to the degree Sean takes notes on every E3 video.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and go through this. So Sakurai reminded us that we have confirmed 72 separate fighters so far. He said, with this direct, we will have announced every fighter in the game. We had a cinematic trailer with Little Mac. He's fighting in the ring, and it turns out it's Ken. Ken turns up the heat, as they told us. So this was our Ken reveal trailer. It was, I think, a very good reveal for Ken, who is an Echo Fighter of Ryu. But then, just when we think that's it, we get Incineroar from Pokemon, who enters the ring. Another good little fake out there. And I have to say, Ken was expected, which was cool. I'm glad they have Ken in there now, because if you've got Ryu, you got to have Ken, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's good.
I mean, I think as they noted, Ken is like the original Echo Fighter of yes. fighting games. So it'd be weird to have all these Echo Fighters and not have the OG show up to fuck some shit up.
And I just love that you can now do a proper like one-on-one Ryu versus Ken match in Super Smash Bros.
Yeah, it is kind of... It was sort of brain-twisting to see that happening. It's like, this is... Right, yeah. This is Smash Brothers. I'm not watching a weird, like, Street Fighter port or something.
Incineroar was a surprise, and to some degree he was a disappointment because he was the last character in the main game they announced, and that is a weird one to hold back on, that Incineroar was our big finale. And I have to say, I did not... I have followed Pokemon more than, like, say, you have, Sean. I did not know what Incineroar was. I had to look it up. I did not know which game he was from. He's from Sun and Moon. He is the final evolution of Litten, which is the fire cat. Litten, I don't think, was the one I chose in Sun. So I just didn't know who he was, and I never finished Sun or Moon. So this was my introduction to Incineroar as a Pokemon. I thought it was pretty cool, though. Like, he's a very different kind of Pokemon than they've chosen before, and they have him... like, pitched as a pro wrestler, and he's always doing, like, these pro wrestler, like, flash things, you know, after he finishes a move, and he just seemed to have a lot of personality. It was very funny. I thought his character model was great. He honestly looks like, as a Smash Brothers character, someone I'm really excited to fight as. He looks like a cool fighter, and as I noted in my notes, he seems cooler for Smash Brothers than he does for the actual Pokemon series, so I'm glad he's here. And I did hear on Twitter afterwards that part of why they might have saved Incineroar for last and why they chose him in specific is I guess he's very popular in Japan. For whatever reason, Incineroar is like this was a big get for like the Japanese audience. They were very excited about it. So in the West, we might have been a little more confused about it, but I guess Japanese Smash Bros. Fans are very happy about Incineroar. We also had a focus on Ken. We learned about how his Hadouken has a different shape. They talked about how you can do Ken's signature moves. He has two final smashes, the Shoryuken and the Shippu Jinrai Kyaku.
Shippu Jinrai Kyaku.
So,
or you misspoke, it was the Shinryuken. The Shoryuken, Rising Dragon Punch, is of course his normal forward quarter circle, or down quarter circle, or diagonal down punch move, the Shinryuken, the true Dragon Fist, is what he does. Awesome. Which I think that in that video they straight up say, I don't remember if it's through the Shinryuken or the Junior Aikyaku, but it's for one of those, they're like, his popular move from the Versus series of games, which is like the Marvel versus Capcom games. So like, that was weird that they just name dropped the Versus series of fighting games in this weird, like I feel like Super Smash Brothers is slowly just encompassing all of video games
yes.
in a way that makes me feel mildly uncomfortable when it happens. Like, what is even happening anymore?
Yes. All right. So we also then got the show off Incineroar. I think one of his attack names was called Mac Malicious Moonsault, which I really liked. So that was good. Sakurai told us the roster has been revealed, showed off the full roster. First, he showed off the starting roster, which you start in this game with just the original 8 from Smash Bros. 64, and they're all very lonely on the main screen. And then he did like a crossfade to all 74 fighters on the roster, and they're all on one page, and it's the most ridiculous thing, and I fucking love it. So yes. Sean, as an outsider looking in, do you have anything to say to fans who are not satisfied with the roster of 74 fighters in Smash Bros. Ultimate?
Where's Goku?
Okay, where's Goku?
Where's Goku?
It is this weird thing where once you have spoiled us as thoroughly as Sakurai has spoiled Smash Brothers fans, we're never going to stop asking for new things. So while you can objectively look at it and say, that is the most thorough fighting roster in any video game ever, it's ridiculous, there's always, like, once you've introduced things like you've got Simon and Richter and you've got Ken and you've got Snake and all this shit, and Ridley came in at this point, you know, you're going to go like, yeah, but what if you did have Geno? You know, what if Sakurai just never stopped working and this game had 500 fighters? What about that?
Yeah, like, that's definitely where you're just like, well, of course Banjo and Kazooie are going to be in this fucking game. Like, how would they not be at this point?
Where's Lara and Croft and, like, the Master Chief and Nathan Drake and Ellie from The Last of Us, who stabs people in the neck with a shiv as her final
Where's the cutscene where fucking Arthur Morgan from Red Dead Redemption 2 just sort of saunters on screen and blows Mario's fucking brains out with the double-barreled shotgun?
Yeah.
Like, give me the fighting game that I want to play.
All right. So we then got a look at some of the new amiibo, like Ridley and Pichu, and then he went into the biggest part of this direct, was explaining the spirits system. This was the part on the main menu that had been blurred out in past directs, although because of Twitter detectives, we all knew it said spirits. So first he announced that collectible trophies, which have been a big part in Smash Bros. Going back to Melee, are no longer... Sakurai is such a candid dude. He said they would be too hard to develop for a game this big because they were these nice, like, 3D modeled trophies. I think that's a fair explanation. So what they've done instead is spirits, which really to say these are a replacement for trophies is selling them short, because what this is it's a replacement for trophies and for the character customization system that was in Smash 4. And so what the spirits are, if I can try to assign... Because they spent like 10 minutes going crazy into the minutia with this, Sean. Did you see any of this?
I skipped this. The only thing about the spirits I saw was how at the end they set up how everybody is dead in a spirit. But that's
yes.
it.
So what it is that... I'm just going to go through my notes because I was trying to follow Sakurai's logic here. He reminded us that in the world of Super Smash Brothers, the fighters are all actually toys, but in our imagination, they're real fighters, and they're fighting to return to the real world. I guess that's the story of Smash Brothers.
Wait, the real world for, like, from the fighter's perspective, for, like, Mario is the real world in Mushroom Kingdom, or they're trying to invade reality?
I think that's right. And he was, like, he was showing, while he talked about this, the opening cutscene from Smash 64 where, like, they get pulled out of the toy box and stuff like that. So he said, in this world, everyone except the fighters becomes a spirit, and fighters can join powers with spirits to gain power. So what the spirits are is they're all the other characters from these different canons that are not actual fighters. So, for instance, you might have things like the Able Sisters from Animal Crossing, or, this one blew my mind, Hal Emmerich from Metal Gear is in Smash Brothers as a spirit.
I think I saw that screenshot because that sounds very familiar to me. And it's just like all these are like... like, straight up, like, concept art or, like, just, like, pictures from their original source material, right? It's not... they didn't, like, make unique art for these. So it's, like, this strange hodgepodge of artistic styles from, like, every different, like, either, like, realistic 3D character models like HAL from freaking Metal Gear, and or there's just some weird shit from, like, Yo-Kai Watch or something that's just in that style, you know?
There was all of that. There's Bullet Bill. There's Dixie Kong, a bunch of Fire Emblem characters. I'm betting we'll get Lindis here, even though we didn't get her in the main game as a fighter. But there's probably, I would guess, hundreds upon hundreds of these things. And you basically, there are primary spirits and secondary spirits. Primary spirits have slots that support spirits can be added into. And this is all like a character customization thing, because you could build a spirit and then assign it to a fighter, and the fighter will get like different kind of perks from that, and you can do spirit battles. This is where you acquire spirits on the spirit board. This is where you pick what spirit you want to acquire and then do a battle with a similar fighter to unlock the spirit. And then the spirits all have different primary attack types, and it's like the weapon triangle from Fire Emblem, where it's attack, grab, shield, and each is strong against a different one. And battles have conditions that give you hints on what spirits to use. And then you can also do battles with other people, local or online, using your spirits. Primary spirits gain experience and level up. You can also feed them snacks. All this crazy stuff. I think it's an interesting system. I think it's a cool way to combine a lot of things that had been building in other Smash Brothers games, because you get to do all the collectibles, that's the word I'm using for. Collectivization would be the Soviet Union. I'm looking for collectibles. So you get to do your collectibles, you get to do a shit ton of fan service, you get to do your character customization, all of that. As Sakurai said, they help you to imagine more battles from more series than ever before. So that was our first look at the Spirits mode. They would do the stuff with the big single-player campaign that is also related to this later. But it's crazy. Like, a lot of people said it sort of looks like a gacha game in some ways. Like, there's no microtransactions involved, so it's not a gacha game that will, you know, ruin your finances. But it does have that kind of thing where you're, like, collecting, and you can, like, if you have a bunch that you don't want, you can trade them in for other spirits or for coins and stuff. And, you know, you try to get the spirits you want, and it's kind of crazy. So that's the Spirits mode. They then showed off local wireless and online play. It was interesting. He detailed how online mode will work. They've gotten rid of the two categories from the last couple games, which was for fun and for glory, which is basically ranked and unranked. And now the way they do matchmaking is by prioritizing three factors. And those three factors are preferred rules, which means before battle, every player chooses their preferred rules, and one player's rules will be chosen at random and everyone will use them. But if possible, the matchmaking tries to find players with similar or identical rules. It factors in your global Smash ranking, which is like your leaderboard ranking. And finally, distance between players, they also factor in. Game tries to find the best match based on geography. Sakurai noted that a LAN cable might help, and he showed off the Nintendo LAN cable adapter for Switch, which worried me a little bit, because I don't want to have to buy one of those.
Huh.
Yeah. I don't think it'll actually need that. I mean, all online games work better with a LAN cable, so I guess that's, you know, fair to say. We'll see how it goes. Showed off elite battles and Smash tags. This is kind of interesting. This is almost like a dog tags mode, where you create your own ID, and like I said, it looks like a dog tag, and when you beat someone online, you get their Smash tag, and if you lose, they get your Smash tag. It's not gone forever, you still have it, it's their proof that they've beat you, and you collect Smash tags. So like, you can go have a screen and look at all the Smash tags you've gotten. So that's kind of an interesting thing they have online. There's spectator mode. This I really like. You can initiate, like, I want to do matchmaking, and then you can go play the game, and it'll matchmake in the background, and when it's ready to put you in a game online, it'll throw you in there. I like, more games should have that.
Yeah.
So you don't have to sit in a lobby. I really like this. You can form a two-player team online on a single system, so you and a friend could be a team on the couch together playing against another team online. That sounds like fun. They mentioned the Nintendo Switch Online app, which is still stupid, but there you go. They then had a big part where they showed off a bunch of assist trophies. These included Yuri Kozukata from Fatal Frame, Isaac from Golden Sun, Black Knight from Fire Emblem Path of Radiance, the Thwomp from Mario, Springman from ARMS. My favorite one was From Mario Paint, it was Flies and Hand, which is like a fly swatter that comes in and hits a fly on screen, and if it hits the player, it like knocks you off the screen. Tiki from Fire Emblem Awakening, Vince from Art Academy, Akira from Virtua Fighter, which is awesome, and it's even in like that very polygonal like Virtua Fighter like graphic shape. There are 59 total assist trophies this time. They actually outnumber Pokemon in this game. The assist trophies look like a lot of fun, so...
Yeah, this reminded me, I had totally forgotten, I saw this video as well, because I saw that, I saw the screenshot of Akira from Virtual Fighter in it, and it's like, that it's straight up, like, it looks like it's just the character model from VF1 in Smash Brothers, which is weird. And then also, the Fatal Frame girl is like, that's like a, Fatal Frame is like a Japanese horror video game series where you take pictures of ghosts. To like capture their souls or some shit, and so that's like, it's, you know, it's got this like really dark J-horror aesthetic, and that was what, again, one of those like, what the fuck is Smash Brothers anymore? Like, this is, you know, a couple steps away from having like Saw being in Smash Brothers. Like, it's, you know, these games can get kind of gory. It's very weird that this is here.
I can't wait for the Gears of War guys in here, where they just come in with a chainsaw and cut Mario in half.
Oh shit! Yeah.
All right, he showed off a bunch of other modes, like 100 Man Smash, which is now called Century Smash. You can play it on every stage in the game now, which was not true before. All-Star Mode is there. He showed off a bunch of like the replay data and the tips and tricks section and all this sort of stuff. He went very far into the minutiae here. He showed off, and this is actually genuinely pretty cool, that the game supports 11 different languages now. And all of the elements in the game switch with the language. So like, if you play as Bulbasaur... Bulbasaur's voiced in all 11 languages and things like that. And there's a different announcer for every language too. So like the typical Smash Brothers announcer, you can go hear him in Russian if you want now, which is kind of neat. And it's there on any version of the game you have. Shut off different, all that stuff. Okay. Now getting into the more interesting stuff. Confirmed that they will be doing DLC. Obviously, the roster is already very big, but they've left the door open to add more fighters this way. He explained that this will take longer than usual because they need to develop new fighters from scratch, because the reason this is called Smash Ultimate is that every fighter they've ever developed is in the game, right? So they need to develop new fighters from scratch. He promised there will not be any Echo fighters in this DLC. Each DLC will cost $5.99, but it'll come with a fighter and a new stage, and multiple music tracks. So that honestly seems pretty good to me. I mean, like, in as a recent point of comparison, in Dragon Ball Fighters, I believe it's $4.99 per fighter.
Yeah.
But it's just the character, right? It's not a new stage or anything?
No, they did. They gave out a free new stage a little bit ago, but that's kind of unrelated. It's like the Galactic Arena or something.
So this is, like, similar price, but you get a fighter and a stage.
There is a new music track for each of the characters, because each character has a music track. So you get that as well when you buy a character.
That's good. So it just this seems pretty much in line with other fighting games from what I could tell. And you can also buy a season pass. They're calling it the Fighter's Pass. It includes all five sets. It's $25, which that's like $5 off if you... Well, so yeah, 6 times 5 is 30, so you save $5 that way. Sakurai was very apologetic. He could not reveal the contents yet. I mean, this seems like it's very much like... This is not one of those cases where they have the DLC, like, planned out, like, you know, or, like, halfway completed or something. Like, they really are going to finish the game and then go work on it. He said one purchase bonus if you get the Fighter's Pass is you get Rex's costume from Xenoblade 2 for your Mii fighters, if you want to use that. Because he said they wanted to put Rex in here, but Rex and Xenoblade 2 came out after they had already finalized the initial roster. So... Yeah, DLC will be coming. Again, Sakurai was surprisingly candid about all this. He thinks it'll take about a year to release all of this. So they have that. But then also they had a free limited time offer if you buy Smash Ultimate now. For a while here, Sakurai kind of sounded like he was doing like a TV sales pitch. But he said, it's not finished yet, but here's a sneak peek. And what we got was the reveal trailer for Piranha Plant. Piranha Plant is now a fighter in Super Smash Bros. Ultimate. He will be the first DLC. He'll be free for everybody. You have to buy the game by January 31st, but if you buy it before then, he's free DLC. And I did not know I wanted Piranha Plant in Smash Bros., but he looks fucking awesome, and it is the stupidest idea but they've done such a good job on it. Did you see this trailer, Sean?
Yes, yeah. This is when I sort of started watching this stuff. I kind of like skipped ahead near the end, saw Piranha Plant. It's like, what the fuck is even happening anymore? And then backed up and watched from there to the end.
It's such a great video, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels, I mean, obviously they could, this is not what it is, but it sort of felt like a troll for all the people that, like, thought that leak was real. Because it's like, no, you're not getting Banjo, you're not getting Shadow, you're getting a fucking Piranha Plant. Which is, like, of all the, like, generic enemies from Mario Brothers that you could have be a fully playable character, I don't think I would have even thought of the Piranha Plant to be one. Because, you know, they have to answer the unanswerable question, which is how the fuck does the Piranha Plant move? And they're just like, eh, he's just in the pipe, and the pipe just kind of hobbles along.
If you look at the animations close, he has feet coming out of the pipe at the bottom.
I don't know how I feel about, is that now canon? Do Piranha Plants have feet? Do they think that Venus Flytraps have feet at Nintendo?
I don't know.
What they think?
But yes, it's Piranha Plant, and it's so silly, and that video, it even starts out making you think the Piranha Plant is going to be an assist trophy or something, and setting up for like, oh, we're getting an assist trophy DLC. No, he's a full-fledged fighter, and it is like all of it, and they have not added arms or anything. All of his attacks are like jumping and lunging with just the like Venus Flytrap part of the Piranha Plant's mouth, and it is so creative and crazy. I'm really excited for it, because they did a second video on the Smash blog later showing off more of his moves in depth. It's a really cool fighter, and such a dumb idea, but I love it. I love it.
It feels like it dropped out of a parallel universe where Super Smash Bros. Was restricted to the Mario franchise, and so every Mario character had to be a fighter in it, like a Goomba, and fucking Piranha Plant, and here's a Koopa Troopa, here's a Paratroopas, like a totally different character with a different moveset.
Yes.
Like, it feels like it just came from that universe, because there are so, so many other characters you could still use that are, like, main characters or, like, secondary characters from their franchise.
Yes.
I mean, Sean,
they still haven't done Waluigi or Toad. You know? And, like, Toad is one of the OG Mario characters. He's their first game. Super Mario Bros., he's the person telling you, your princess is in another castle. We still don't have Toad, but we have the fucking Piranha Plant.
Yeah, there's something going on behind the scenes at Nintendo to get that done.
It's so great. All right. And then our one more thing was the new adventure mode. As Sakurai told us, it's not quite like Subspace Emissary from Brawl, but it is still basically a somewhat story-driven adventure mode. The question being, what caused all of these fighters to lose their spirits? And then we get the opening cutscene of the game. It starts with Fox on a cliff going, "Don't let a single one get away." And then everybody, all 74 fighters, are there on the cliff. And in the sky, a bunch of Master Hands are coming at them. Marth notes that they will all need to take out at least 10 Master Hands. And then the Master Hand's gloves come off, and there's blue energy underneath. And then shit goes crazy, and everyone is incinerated. They turn into spirits floating around. It's a very traumatic trailer as you watch, like, Sonic running away and trying to reach out for Pikachu. And Pikachu gets incinerated, and then Sonic can't run fast enough. And at the end, only Kirby has escaped. And then as Kirby looks out over this ruined world, we get a vocal version of the Smash Brothers theme song in both English and Japanese, depending on what you watched. They're both great. I think the Japanese is better, but they're still both very cool. It is a goddamn amazing cutscene. And then they showed off Spirit Adventure Mode, which is called World of Light. And it's like this big overworld map that's beautiful and hand-drawn. You walk around it to activate fights and do, like, story events. It basically looks like what a lot of Smash Bros. Fans like me have been asking for years, which is sort of like, what if you did Subspace Emissary with a lot of, like, Subspace Emissary, I think, had a lot of good ideas, but, like, the platforming level design just did not work with this game's style of fighting. This feels like a proper, really cool, in-depth, one-player mode that you would want out of a fighting game, and the right one for Smash Brothers. And again, that cutscene was crazy.
Yeah, like, I'm not going to pretend to understand anything of what the fucking mode is, but this, like, cutscene that was, like, felt like what if Hideaki Anno directed a fucking Super Smash Brothers movie where the Master Hands come, like, descend from heaven and just fucking disintegrate all your favorite characters, except for Kirby, of course. If Kirby's the one to do escape. And it's just, like, the darkest fucking shit imaginable. It's so, so crazy. And this is also the point where it's like, was the point of no return for Goku. Because how fucking awesome would it have been if while those beams were coming down and everyone's like freaking out and running away and they can't stop it, you just hear from off the screen, "Cop! Mid! Hop! Mid! Ha!" And the fucking Kamehameha comes in and blocks the beam, and fucking Goku's there, and he's like, "Don't worry, I'm gonna take care of shit," and then he just blows them all up, and then it's like, we win, it's Goku.
Yes. Let's take the Goku thing seriously for just a second, Sean, because I just am interested in this.
Goku should be in the game.
Okay, so Masahiro Sakurai, clearly beyond a shadow of a doubt, knows what the fans want, right? Is that a fair thing to say at this point?
Yeah.
He's very aware of the tenor of fandom. If Sakurai could put Goku in this game, do you think he would be in it? And if not, I guess that means... My assumption is that that's not something Toei would be up for, but I don't know.
Yeah, like, it would be a step that they have not yet taken, which is putting a character that does not originate from a video game into Smash Brothers, because every other character originates from a video game. Goku is obviously in more video games than probably almost any other Smash Brothers character other than, like, Mario. And so he qualifies in my fucking book.
He's been in a lot of Nintendo games. People, like, they didn't come out over here, but on the NES and the Super NES, he's been in all sorts of video games.
Yeah, there's already, like, two or three. There's Xenoverse 2 and Dragon Ball FighterZ, but Xenoverse 2 on the Switch has the Xenoverse 1 stuff in it. So there's basically three Dragon Ball games already on the Switch.
Yep.
It's just more games than fucking Link has, you know? So put Goku in that fucking thing.
I think it would be cool. Has Goku appeared in anyone else's fighting games? Like, there's been Jump crossovers, but, like, my sense is Toei does not loan out their characters that easily.
Yeah, I mean, especially crossover Goku. Characters in fighters are not super common outside of, obviously, you have, like, the big versus series, which are typically, like, different, you know, other than Marvel vs. Capcom, which is the Marvel characters. Typically, it's like, here's a bunch of SNK characters and Capcom characters, whatever, getting together. So it's typically guest characters are all from other fighting games. You obviously have notable exceptions like Soul Calibur does a bunch of crazy shit. Like Geralt and 2B are in Soul Calibur 6. You had all the Star Wars people in Soul Calibur 4. So it's like Goku has not, to my knowledge, that's probably not true. There has got to be some weird fucking like Sega Saturn fighting game that had Goku in it or something. You know, there have been a lot of fighting games and Goku has been a character that has existed for basically longer than the fighting game genre has existed. So there's a chance.
If they could do it one day, and I would not rule out the possibility that the DLC gets crazy and we could get one of these, because as people have pointed out, when you have more development time, as they will for doing, you know, a single DLC character, and you have a, like, guaranteed, like, financial flow on those, they could go for bigger, like, third-party gets on those if they want to. So, again, I would not rule out that some of these crazy things could happen. Given how well they've done with all the characters in this game so far, I want to see what Sakurai would do with Goku. I want to see what his final Smash would be, because it would be awesome. You just know it.
I mean, honestly, I would be fine if they just fucking looked at his moveset from Dragon Ball FighterZ and were like, okay, like, his normal B is Kamehameha, his up B is, like, the hurricane kick thing he does in FighterZ, his forward B is that dash forward punch down move he does, and then down B can be, like, a charge of spear bomb or whatever you want it to be, you know?
Yeah.
You've already got a lot of models for how you can make a Goku. I just want them to make a Goku.
Yeah. Well, maybe one day. Maybe one day, Sean. But for now, that is Super Smash Bros. Ultimate. I think this was a fun direct. Getting that confirmation of a big, meaty single-player mode was huge for me. And I think I'm at the point where, like, I remember when this was announced at E3, Sean, you asked me, is this Smash 4 Deluxe or is this a new game? And I was like, it seems like it's maybe 4.5. I think now that we're close to release, we've had all these directs, it's Smash 5. This is not an in-between game. This is not a remake. This is... Clearly, a lot of the elements of Smash 4 formed a basis here, but, like, I honestly, in some ways, this feels like a bigger new game than 4 was versus Brawl. Like, this is so huge. It has so many characters. Like, it has fewer new, I don't even know if it has fewer new characters. It has 7 all new, completely from scratch characters, and then like 5 or 6 new Echo Fighters. So it's got a ton of new characters. Some of those new characters are nutso, like King K. Rool and Ridley, and things we never thought we were actually going to get. It's got over 100 stages. It's got the 900 music tracks. It's got the whole Spirits mode. It's got World of Light. Like, this game looks like it has a character and voice all its own. And I am sufficiently hyped, let's just say. I cannot wait for this fucking thing.
Yeah, I agree with you. And a big part of it for me is that, like, a story mode thing does so much to give a game a sense of identity, you know? Even just from the outside, knowing nothing about it. Because, like, Smash 4 just, like, nothing in the marketing of that game ever, like, sold me on, like, the identity of Smash 4 because it just didn't have, like, Subspace Emissary or Adventure Mode, or obviously the original Smash Brothers is like old and it just had the arcade stuff, but Melee and Brawl had this like specific mode that I looked at as like, okay, this is the mode for this game, that is the mode that only this game has, that is like fleshed out and interesting and different. And I didn't obviously really play it much before, but it didn't feel like that. It didn't feel like when they showed videos of it, it was just like, this is just, they're just showing videos of people playing Smash, like, versus matches on Smash Brothers, whereas this Nintendo Direct and that ending thing felt like, that's something in this Smash Brothers game that looks like has not been in any other Smash Brothers game, and I need at least one of those for me to feel like this is a new Smash Brothers game.
Absolutely. I love Smash 4 for 3DS and Wii U. I'm probably one of the few people who thinks that the 3DS one is better. Not necessarily, like, to go play competitively. I don't mean like that. I just think it was a little tighter of a package. It had the better single-player mode. But, like, Smash 4 did not have as cohesive an identity as any of the other Smash Bros. Games. It was, you got to play Super Smash Bros. In HD or on the go, and it was a really good, tight, the best version of the basic fighting game up to that point. But it was, as a package, it lacked the identity that it feels like this one really has in spades. And I think that identity is there just in kind of the maximalist philosophy of, we're going to have 74 fighters and 100 stages, and we're going to have every other character under the sun. I mean, fucking Revolver Ocelot is in this thing via the Spirits mode. It's like, the cuts are deep, and I am very excited. This game basically feels like, and this could not have happened because it was too recent, but it feels like Masahiro Sakurai saw that tweet where Marvel said, Avengers Infinity War is the most ambitious crossover of all time, and he said, hold my beer, you know? And he's like, I'll show you what the most ambitious crossover is. And then he, like, you know, worked himself to death making this game.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, there is a whole, like, conversation to have at some point about, like, how different the, like, people, the way that people talk about overworking in concept, in or context of Sakurai and Smash Brothers and the Rockstar stuff, because it's like, having that, like, juxtaposed so immediately was like, this feels kind of, like, I got a little bit of whiplash.
But Sakurai's doing it to himself. We all want him to rest.
But it's exactly that meme. It's exactly that joke. It's like, but we're, like, we're over here having this conversation about, like, unionization and labor laws. Because they all do it to themselves. Like, that's the point.
Well,
no, they... like,
but Sakurai is the guy in charge. It's a little different than Hausers, if you're hearing anonymously from...
Fucking guarantee you the Housers are working 80 to 100 hour weeks on the crunch of Red Dead Redemption. They are the people in charge of that game. Like, but they do it to themselves and trickle it down to everybody else.
But my only point was that why the Red Dead 2 thing blew up is because, I mean, they bragged about it, but it wasn't that we had concern for the physical health of Dan Houser. It was because we had concern for all of his employees.
Yeah, and we just, because of the way that labor works in Japan, we have absolutely no visibility into the work practices and the work ethic of Nintendo's internal studios. But if the guy at top is working so hard that it's been memeified that he should take a rest, maybe that should give you some sort of inkling of, maybe that trickles down there as well. I don't know.
It's
maybe
Japan.
Persona 5
I've
was talking about
that.
Some shit.
And it hurts when I'm watching any anime or playing a video game, but, you know, it is what it is, unless it's Persona 5 and they're tackling it very head on.
Yeah. It was just very strange to get all the jokes when I was like so in the like Rockstar Red Dead thing and then seeing all those jokes on Twitter, especially since, you know, I was on the outside and wasn't even watching the direct at that point. Just like, what the fuck are people? This is weird.
All right. Well, that's a good transition. Let's talk about Red Dead Redemption 2. Again, I doubt we're going to get into any spoiler territory this week because we are at such different points in the plot. Like, I have things I can say maybe in a general sense of whether I think things are good or bad, but I don't think that counts as a spoiler. So yeah, let's talk about Red Dead Redemption 2. As we talked about at the top of the show, Sean, it sounds like you and I are playing this game very differently. I'm on the last chapter, you are on the third chapter.
Just moved my camp for the first time outside of the beginning of the game.
I've done it so many times. So yes, you've just gotten to that third chapter, which really is kind of like the second chapter, because the first is a prologue sort of thing.
Yeah.
So you're in the second main like area of the game, and
I will give you one even better, Jonathan. Yesterday was the day I unlocked the ability to manually paint targets on people in Deadeye.
I had
been suffering through the terrible, like, it just automatically tags people in Deadeye thing forever, to the point where I just stopped using Deadeye, because I get that it was in the first game, and the first game worked that way. I don't know why they did it in the second game, because dumb. Like, just give you the good Deadeye immediately.
Or let you choose at the beginning.
For most people, you did get the good Deadeye immediately. It was just me and my very lackadaisical manner playing this game that's like, it took me a long time to get to that fucking train robbery mission or wherever you get it.
Wow.
Sort of randomly.
So, Sean, I am so far ahead of you in some ways, but I'm on a parallel track. I can't say I'm ahead of you or behind you or whatever. Like, we are playing the games very differently, and I'm just so fascinated. How are you playing Red Dead Redemption 2, and what are your thoughts this week?
I love it. I think I love it more even than last time. And how I'm playing it is just, I mean, it is like a lot of what I described last time of like, I'm playing cowboy dress up and I'm going around and I'm just living in that world and kind of doing mundane things and getting wrapped up in random shit. I've also spent some time, like just sort of experimenting and I'm like making saves and going and doing some rough shit. That I know is like, I'm going to load the save because I don't want to lose all this money and honor and stuff. And just like to find out, like, what happens if I go and attack this town this way? And so there have probably been like maybe 3 hours of progress, of playtime in that game that has been like sort of in this weird parallel universe where it's like, what if Arthur Morgan just totally snapped all of a sudden? And is like, I'm just going to rob, like, find out how you rob banks or like find out how you do this shit and
you
just
did a Jonathan
see what it's like.
Through.
Yes, I did the Jonathan. For a little bit, it was just like, I'm just going to see how this feels, and then I'm going to go back to being a sane person playing this video game and not a sociopathic serial killer. Yeah, but it is just, I just like the mood of the game so much. I like the tone and just the vibe of living in that world and really, you know, my big sort of like key word last week was expression and expressivism and being able to express myself through the character. And then like another thing I've kind of sort of focused on is like in conjunction with that is the embodiment I feel of Arthur Morgan. And it's like, it's a combination of me expressing what I want to express as the character in this sort of like cowboy scenario in this like Western fantasy thing. But then it's also like the character of Arthur Morgan expressing to me through like my embodiment of him, of the things that he would do and would want to do. And so it's like, I will just go and eat food and like, not because I actually need to for any real gameplay reason, but this is like, when I'm making camp, I'm going to, you know, cook up this rabbit with some nice herbs that I've gathered and just eat it because it's like, I want, you know, Arthur Morgan needs to eat something. And he doesn't literally, there's no gameplay. There's no like, you know, Minecraft-esque hunger meter exactly. There's enough of it that forces you to sleep every once in a while or whatever to really reset all your cores. Or you have to spend a lot of resources to keep that stuff up. But I'm just sort of like living in that world through Arthur Morgan. And it is something where I just have not felt a huge pull and draw to have to do the story missions. Like, I will do them. And I'm never, like, making the explicit decision to avoid doing story missions. It's just, like, I will end up being like, oh, I will realize I spent the whole day, like, tracking down, like, this treasure and like, hunting these things and just, like, got up into random hijinks. And I never kind of got around to getting back to the camp and talking to John Marston or whatever. Because that was one of the ones I was hung up for on, like, a while, was just going and talking to John at the camp. I don't even remember what the fuck he wanted to do. It was, like, it was the one that, like, before you end up taking Jack fishing. It was, like, the one right before that mission. I think that's when you go, like, rustle some sheep or something. It was, like, I just, like, it took me a long time to get around to that because I was just not at camp. I was out over, like, way to the west dealing with shit in Strawberry and, like, hanging out with the Trapper and doing cool shit over there. And it's like, it's going to take me a while to get back to camp. And so I might as well do all the shit I want to do over here before I head back. And that's just kind of how I've been playing, is having fun adventures, living my best cowboy life.
So, like, what kind of things have you been doing? Because I guess this is a question for me is, I've done, you know, random adventuring out in the field. You can't not do that kind of thing when you're playing a game like this, right? But, I don't know. Like, a lot of the things you can go do, like, I have no desire to do the hunting. It's just too much for me. I like rob people and stuff. Or, like, I'll take a stagecoach and go fence it. But, like, I don't know. Like, I'm not really into that stuff. The fishing I find kind of interesting, but never enough to, like, really devote the time to it. I find the Stranger missions is something I want to talk about, because I think that's where annoying Rockstar rears its ugly head in this game for me. Yeah. And I avoid those like the fucking plague at this point. But I don't know. Like, what kind of things are you doing out in the world?
I mean, it is like I will go out with like a... So one thing I've been doing is I've been focusing on the challenges more recently. So it's doing like the treasure stuff, hunting, where it's like, for me, hunting for a long time, I was like, man, not so into it. It's like, it's kind of fine. It wasn't until it kind of like really hit me of like, this is like the sort of play cycle of hunting in the game and making sure you have the right equipment and find like stalking the animal and trying to get the right shot and finding like the pristine deer or whatever I need and killing it with the right weapon to get the right pelt and that kind of stuff of where it's like hard to describe what I'm doing because it's like I'm not... I have like very mundane objectives of like, oh, I'm going to go over here because I'm pretty sure I know where this treasure map is leading me to. And that will be something that normally would take you like 10 minutes, maybe 5 minutes, depending on how far away you are. But it's something where on the way I get sidetracked by so much shit and just have like a bunch of random adventures. And one, like, you know, it's just like I have like a bunch of like random stories of things I did. One of my favorites is when I was doing poker. And so I was at... And this is something where it's like, I haven't even found, like, been to any of the major cities, really, outside of that one anecdote I told last week about the St. Denis thing. So it's like, me playing poker is, I'm in that podunk little rundown fucking, like, train station where there's a mission where you go to find the reverend there and you can play poker there. And I stumbled upon that again. I don't remember what else I was doing, but I was just there. I was like, oh, I'm going to play some poker. I think it's because the guy who gives you the fucking collection, the collective, like, get all the cigarette cards is over there or something, which there's a bunch of dumb collectibles in this game that I don't really give a shit about, that I don't know why they're there, like the dinosaur bones and the stone etchings, that it's just like, I have found almost none of that shit, and I don't know why that part is in the game. But I stopped because of that guy. I was like, might as well say play some poker while I'm here. So I hitch up my horse, I go in, and I start playing poker, and I'm fucking cleaning up. And, you know, it's only like, you know, each guy has probably about $2 total. So cleaning up is not getting a tremendous profit. And I am kind of, I think, maybe broken the economy of the game a little bit because I'm maybe a bit too rich for what I'm at in the game. Because I had $1,500 a little bit ago.
That is early to have that much money, yes.
Yeah, and I spent about $700 to $800 of those dollars on clothes and gun customization because I'm like, might as well. So I bought almost every shirt I think that you can buy.
Well, the game, this is something you'll see. The game kind of breaks its own economy. You're going to come on it soon. The game comes to a point where it just gives you so much money through the campaign missions that, like,
yeah.
I've just had to go spend it on stuff because if I die out in the world, I lose a little bit of it. So I'm like, and I can't put it in a bank or anything. So, you know, fuck it. I'm going to just go spend it on random shit. And yes, I have spent a lot of money on clothes. I did buy a $1,000 horse. It's a very nice horse. Nice. I've been naming all my horses after Dragon Ball villains. My first horse was Emperor Pilaf, which I think is a great racehorse name.
It is.
If I ever have enough money to buy a racehorse, Sean, he will be named Emperor Pilaf. But my $1,000 horse I named Ma Jr.
Good. Yes, after Piccolo's name in the world tournament. Very good. That's a deep cut.
Yes. So
it was back to playing poker because I had my horse that I named Tennessee because it was the Tennessee Straddler or whatever the fuck that race of horses is called. Like, and that was the first horse I got outside of the shit horse you initially start with, and I captured this Tennessee horse, and I was like, I'm just going to name you Tennessee, and you're my horse, and I love you, and you're beautiful. So I saddle up my horse, whatever, or I hitch it up to the post, go playing poker, and just wiping the floor with these stinky old men that only have $2. And I had, like, this was before I finished that one treasure quest, where that's how I got, like, $1,500 in one go, because they give you 3 gold bars, each worth $500. And so, but at this point, I probably had, like, $600 or something. So making kind of a pittance, but this is how I unlocked the gambler, whatever, challenges or something, which is to win a bunch of poker hands. So the first level of that is to win a bunch of poker hands. So I'm just cleaning up, playing some poker, doing my business. In the middle of playing poker, I kind of hear there's some commotion outside, but I'm not really paying attention to it. It's like, something's going on. And just playing poker, and eventually it's like, okay, I think I bet big on one hand and lost about $1, big for this game was losing about $1, although I had net gained like $6 or $7. I'm like, okay, I'm good. I'm not gonna, you know, lose all the money I made because I'm not that good at poker. And so I cleared out of the game, got up, was like, gentlemen, have a nice day. And I walked out the door and was immediately met with a horrifying scene of my horse, Tennessee, my beautiful Tennessee, dead. On the ground.
What?
Tennessee had been killed for circumstances. I have no idea what the fuck happened. To this day, I do not know what happened to my Tennessee. But it was whatever that commotion was halfway through that was like, something's going on outside, but I'm sure it's not related to me at all. Like, is a train passing or something? Something happened then that killed my horse. And you know, the game did not, this is not what happened in the game. Nothing in the game did support this. But in my head, in part of it, I was just so upset by what just happened. In my head, I created this sort of scenario. Because part of what it was is when I walked out, I went through another room that had like 3 guys in it that were just standing around chatting, and it looked really fucking shifty, and I just didn't like the look of those dudes. So after I went out of that room with those 3 random dudes, not the guys playing poker, but other dudes, and that's when I saw my horse, my headcanon of what happened was all those guys saw that I was cleaning up at this poker game, and they're like, fuck this guy, we're going to kill his fucking horse because he's taking all our money. They killed my horse, and that's... Again, that's no way what actually happened. But in my head, that's what happened. So I see that. I'm very upset. And I go right back in. And I just, like, look at these fuckers. I pull both my guns and just fire from the hip at all the guys still seated at the poker table. And they're looking up at me like, oh, hey, you're back again. Want to lose some more money? And I just fire from the hip. Both of my revolvers just blasting these guys. Like, one of them slumps over on the table, like where the chips are. One of them falls backwards out of his chair. One of them, like, gets shot in the leg and gets up and kind of limps out the door. And I kind of look at him run. And I go into the other room where all the other guys are. And I blow all of them away too. And then I walk out the door, see the one guy from the poker table that's still limping off to the distance. Put one more bullet back in my revolver, aim, and just shoot him in the back of the head and walk away. And it was like... And that's, to me, that's what Red Dead Redemption 2 is at its best, is I basically end up playing the great, like, first 10 minutes of an old Western movie.
Yes.
That's just like, this is how you get introduced to this character, is through this, like, strange scenario.
It's John Wick in the Old West. They killed his horse. He killed them.
And it is just that thing about this game that if you're willing to, like, really play with it and give it some rope and, like, kind of get invested in it and kind of roleplay... It gives you so many opportunities and so many tools to really play around with that stuff. And there's so many random scenarios and things and little, like, events and things that you encounter along the way, which is 100% how I get sidetracked. And I just get so involved in the, like, minutia of what I'm doing and the spectacle of the game, because so many of the gameplay systems are not necessarily great in and of themselves. Like, if you drop this third-person combat system into a Gears of War type game that, or even like an Uncharted that relied way more on combat all the time, it wouldn't really hold up that much. But when you just look at it as the spectacle of the performance of violence in this game world, it's so, like, intoxicating almost. And it's that, like, really visceral moment of me just opening fire with these guns from the hip and just blowing these guys away at the table. And it's the animations and the sound effects and everything that's going on, and, like, the very deliberate, like, reloading your gun or cocking each shot if you're firing with a rifle or with only one revolver, that it that theatricality of it, I get so wrapped up in. And that's how I just end up spending a whole day playing this game, having random little things that happen like that off on out on the road that, you know, I probably have one story like that every 2 or 3 hours I play the game. It's not a constant thing popping off all the time, but when it happens, it feels really special.
I totally get all that. And this is actually a good point to transition into some of my experience with the game. Because, so you said the thing about how, you know, not every system is great, but put all together, they have this kind of synergy, and I totally get that. Yeah. But you also said, if you put this fighting system into a game that relied really heavily on it, it wouldn't hold up. I have some bad news for you, Sean.
Yeah, the story missions. Yeah.
That's the entire campaign. It's weird. So I have been playing the campaign very, like, go ahead, you know, play the whole thing. I have definitely done things in between missions and gone on little adventures, but I have felt a draw to the campaign. And I have some negative things to say about the game, but I want to stress again, this is very unusual for me in a Rockstar game. Like, I remembered the exact timeline, Sean, last week when we were debating, like, when did I actually play Red Dead 1? I got it pretty close after release. I didn't finish the campaign until we lived in the condo together, which was 2 years later. Like, these, and that was true of GTA 4, took me, like, over a year to beat. GTA 5, I, like, was kind of dragged kicking and screaming into finishing the game for the podcast.
Yeah.
But other than that, like, the way I play Rockstar games is generally, like, the story's whatever, I want to go fuck around in the world, because even in the best Rockstar story mode, which up until this point was Red Dead 1, it's never as good as just going and making your own adventures. Like, is that a fair, like, assessment of these games?
Yeah.
And the thing about Red Dead 2 is I was kind of fully expecting that. And then you meet Arthur Morgan. And I think Arthur Morgan is the best character they've ever written. And at the point I am in the game, I will double down on that statement. And I don't mean best, like protagonist. I mean, he's just the best character they've ever written. He's the most interesting. He's the most dimensional and nuanced. And, like, I think the best encapsulation of their, like, you know, masculine crime energy philosophy at Rockstar. And I think someone like Dutch Vanderland is very high on that list, too, because he's basically a cult leader. And the way they, like, bring you into that world is really engaging. And most of the other characters are great. And I think, for the most part, this is not a game that does well by women. But I tweeted about that a couple days ago. I've now gotten to a point where Sadie Adler has become a much bigger character. And she's a great character. And totally one of the best women Rockstar has ever written. So, like, I'm so engaged in the characters. I think the moment-to-moment writing is so good. The dialogue is so good. I love listening to the syntax of these character voices. All of that is true. And it's also got this great hook because it's a prequel where basically, you know, this is the story of not this gang on the rise. It's their disillusion. It's got this really interesting emotional hook for me where it's basically, it's Heat in the Old West. You know, it's Michael Mann's Heat, but now in the Old West. Whereas GTA 5 was Heat with a lobotomy. I think is the way I would say that. And so it's got that kind of Heat-esque hook where, like, you know, I'm not sure who is the Robert De Niro character in this scenario. There's no, like, Dutch Vanderland in Heat. But yeah, it's that sort of thing. And so this was drawing me along. But the more I've played, and I would say this did not settle in for me until, like, the back half of Chapter 3. So a little ways away from where you are now. Is it starts to fall into a lot of the bad Rockstar trappings, where I think they go on narrative cul-de-sacs, where we have an area of the map, we want this section of the game to be on this area of the map, we don't really have a major story to tell here, so we're going to go in circles until we decide this shit's going to go bad, and then you're going to have to move to another area. And Chapter 3 is that, and Chapter 4 is that, and then there's a shift after that. But it definitely, you feel a little bit of the narrative cul-de-sac. It's not as bad as in any other Rockstar game. That's the thing. Like, every problem this game has that is in other Rockstar games, this game has less of that. So it has less of the narrative cul-de-sac effect, but it's still there. I think this game, as an open-world campaign, is very poorly paced, because the Rockstar pacing thing with open-world games is the most weird and outdated thing about it to me at this point, which is that, like, again, I have played 70 missions in this game. That's crazy. That is too much. You just cannot pace a game like this if you have 70 of these fucking things, and they're these kind of bite-sized little missions, and because they have multiple ones on the map at the same time, most missions will not have a major shift in the character or the story. They just kind of are wheel spinny kind of things until you get to the big mission. Again, not as bad as like GTA 4, where there's that whole part on the middle island where you have 25 missions with the Italians to do before you can move on to like the bank heist, you know? It's not that bad, but it is still this and adding to the narrative cul-de-sac effect, and it just doesn't feel that well paced. And then, like, this disappoints me a lot. I think chapters 1 and 2 have really good mission variety in that I feel like I'm doing a lot of different things with the characters because they're introducing you to the world. And about halfway through chapter 3, and it has been that way ever since, with the exception of one or two missions, every single mission is you ride on a horse somewhere and talk to people. You get to the place. You think you're going to do something. The thing goes wrong. You shoot endless hordes of enemies, and you shoot, and you shoot, and you shoot, and the shooting is not in-depth enough to support this, and the game is very, very easy. There's really no challenge to it, especially if you are using your Deadeye meter. And once you've killed enough people, you move on, and you ride away, and on your way back, there will be a couple stragglers, and you kill the stragglers, and then you get back to camp, or wherever you're going to leave off, and you go on your separate ways. And when it wants to escalate from that, it does the heat bank heist sequence where, oh my god, we're doing a robbery and it all went wrong. We have to kill so many people. But the thing that made that brilliant in Michael Mann's Heat is that it's the turning point in the movie. There's one sequence like that. There are a dozen of them in Red Dead 2. And by the time you get to the real turning point sequence, it's like, yeah, I've done this a million times. I've killed whole fucking armies at this point in this game. Why is this the breaking point? And that is a frustration for me because it feels like, and I wrote a thread on this today because I was just trying to work out my thoughts on this. There's such a focus on, I don't know if realism is the right word, but verisimilitude might be the right word, of like really making you feel like this world is a layered, dense, nuanced thing that you exist in and you have to eat food and survive and you talk to people. And it's all those like Shenmue elements that we talked about, right? All those survivalist elements. But then you go into the missions and it's Arthur Morgan kills 50 people in an afternoon. And there's just literally no way to reconcile that with anything the game is doing. There's no way to reconcile it with the much more sober storytelling style of this game where, like, you know, Arthur will be thinking about morality and then he'll kill 50 cops in Saint Denis. And it's like, there's just, it didn't, that does not bother me in GTA 4 or Red Dead 1 because those games aren't thinking about that in that way. But this game is constantly asking you to think about the verisimilitude of this world, and then you go kill thousands of people in the game. It's the Uncharted 2 effect, except Uncharted 2, you know, again, does not ask you to think about that. It does not have Nathan Drake sit down and be like, oh, what's the morality of murder? You know, like, whereas this game is thinking about those things. And it feels like the combat to me in this game is one of the bigger missed opportunities I've ever seen in a video game, because it is so easy for me to imagine a version of Red Dead 2 that adopted a more like Last of Us style survivalist kind of combat where you felt like a person in this world and the people you were killing were people and there were stakes and weight. And it's not. It's the exact same style of combat design that they have been doing since Grand Theft Auto 4. The combat is better now, it is tighter now, it plays better now, but the way they put cover in the world, the number of enemies they throw at you, it has not evolved alongside the storytelling and the world systems and all of that. And I think when you combine that with a open world pace that has not evolved substantially enough for me since 2008 for them, And you know, there are games like Witcher 3 and Breath of the Wild and all these other great open world recent games rattling around in my head that just have nailed some of this shit down. It's just, where this game is good, it is so good. And I feel like there are all these gameplay elements that are just not maximizing that. And the mission design is just such a letdown consistently for me in this game. It shows such a lack of imagination and creativity. And I find myself both deeply invested in this story and deeply invested in what I am, and deeply frustrated with what I am playing. And it's a weird disconnect, and I don't quite know what to think about it. So those are kind of my thoughts at this point.
Yeah, like, honestly, because you said that happens, like, the back half of Chapter 3. That happens Chapter 2, like, okay, immediately. That is basically, like, it's not literally every single mission. It's because it's usually, like, you have a couple of missions that are very short missions that set up for the mission that is you shoot 50 people or whatever, yeah. And do the sort of formula you described, which is basically how every Rockstar game has been since at least San Andreas, with like a couple of obviously like exceptions where they do a couple of missions or a little stretch here that's a little bit more experimental. The main difference is with Red Dead 2, at least where I'm at so far, they at least have a couple of the smaller missions that are like, it's just this like dumb little like, you know, it's either fishing with Jack or it's just like a, here's just like, you just ride out and kind of talk to these people that like nothing really happens.
Those are gone like, so at this point. That's what okay. I mean. Like those are, cause you're correct. I was trying to, in my head, not, I didn't want to be unfair to the game. I forgot when this really set in for me. But in Chapter 2, like, fishing with Jack is probably still my favorite mission in this game, and there has not been anything like it since. And I thought it was going to be maybe a regular component of this game, and it's not.
Yeah, I mean, it is a regular component in the game in the sense of you do that on your own, right? Like, you go out and you, like, have that in the world on your own, and you don't really have the, you know, whole cinematic story thing around it, but, like, you know, that is a tutorial mission that teaches you how to fish, is the reason why that mission...
But it also shows a side of Arthur Morgan and of Jack and of, like, this world and the stakes that you don't get elsewhere.
But I think you do, because you do just, like, that's the one thing about being able to talk to people in the world and in the camp is that you do get that stuff. It's not in the fully produced cinematic way, but that's one of the things, I think, one of the reasons why I haven't felt hurried to continue with the story missions is that I am still continuously have been encountering new dialogues with people in the camp, new events, new dialogues between people in the camp, ones that I have no idea if, you know, are ones that you would not be able to hear if you push the story forward. Some of them you probably absolutely would not be able to because the context would change so much that they wouldn't make sense. But it's like, I felt like time was still progressing and it didn't feel like I was putting the game on pause or whatever, or putting like the world on pause while I was going out and having my own wacky adventures the way it has in literally every other video game where it's like, okay, like you guys all, you know, freeze in place and I'm going to go do wacky adventures and then I'm going to come back and then you can start the cutscene. It obviously will do that for like the one, like John or whoever I am that I'm kind of like waiting on to go do that mission. But the rest of the world lives on and changes and people have conversations and the relationships shift in subtle ways in the camp. So it does manage to do that stuff in smaller ways if you're not, you know, doing the main story stuff. But I'm 100% with you that even in just like the relative to you, the meager number of story missions that I've done, like every time it's become the big shootout, which is most of the time, that's where the combat is by far the least interesting because the combat in the game is fun when it is like brief and impactive. And that's like what I was describing with that sequence that I had with the people playing poker is that whole scenario played out over the course of like me walking in and pulling my guns. That was like 10 seconds, right? But that's the way it would be in a movie. In a movie, it's like you don't go for fucking 15 minutes and just shoot tons and tons of people unless it's John Wick, unless it's like the high scene in Heat or something where it's like that's the whole point of this whole, like almost kind of the point of the movie is you have that whole sequence. But for most Westerns, it's like, you know, you shoot a couple of people, like Clint Eastwood comes in and kills a few people and then has a duel at the end and it's like, there you go. Like, you know, his body count in A Fistful of Dollars is probably like 8 people total. Like, it's not that much. And for most video games, you need to have a lot of people to kill because that's the only way, particularly for a shooter, to express, like, the combat in any meaningful way. And without it, it's just like you would have, it's like Uncharted 4 where you have almost kind of not enough combat because you don't even get to experiment with everything the combat has to offer because there aren't that many encounters to play with. And Red Dead 2, it feels like, has the opposite issue that, like, you just wanted to, like, be restrictive, like, pull back more. Because the thing that is fun and interesting about the combat is not the big shootout. It's, like, the sudden, like, I'm going to pull my gun, and it is on, and I'm just going to blast this dude. And it's not fun because it's difficult. It's not fun because there's a combat puzzle or something, the way that, you know, in, like, Halo, the combat is fun because the system of the combat itself is very enjoyable and complicated and has this sort of puzzle-like and dance-like element to it. In Red Dead Redemption 2, what is enjoyable about the gameplay to me is 100% the theatricality of it, which is something that most video games don't have the resources to be able to accommodate that, right? And it's something that Red Dead Redemption 2 has this whole production around it that makes it so that when I, you know, have a thing that, like, I just did earlier today where I was hunting the legendary coyote, and in the middle of doing that whole thing, I stumbled upon one of the gang that's in that kind of Louisiana area that pulled over and had murdered some guy who is driving a carriage and trying to get the lockbox open, and I roll up on them and see what's going on. And first I, like, kind of diffuse the situation, say, like, oh, it's cool, go on, like, I'm not going to do anything. And they hop on their carriage and start driving away, and as soon as their backs are to me, I pull my guns and shoot them both in the back of the head, and that's, like, a cool moment. And it's everything of, like, the sound effects and the animation and the design and the lighting of the world and the scenario and the writing and the believability and the verisimilitude of everything that goes into that, that makes that little moment to me just as entertaining as a, like, really well-executed combat design in a more combat-focused game like a Gears of War. It's just entertaining in a totally different way. And I'm with you that, you know, I'll obviously have a lot more to say about it once I've played more of the story missions, but the story missions have not been giving me that, and maybe that's one of the reasons why I've been so focused on messing around in the open world, because that gives me that all the time.
There's just a real disconnect here for me between what they have built in the open world and the amount of interlocking systems that are potentially in play here that don't really go into the missions at all. Mm-hmm. Like, honestly, as we have this conversation, I guess one of the things that's settling for me in my mind that I find frustrating is that if your primary focus is on the campaign while playing through, which it has been for me, again, it's not the only thing I'm doing. I'm going out and doing other adventures and stuff, but primarily I've been sticking to the campaign. The player is very incidental in Red Dead Redemption 2 in that scenario. Because when you're going through a campaign mission, the game wants to control things for you with such an iron fist that it feels like it does not open up for the player much. And I think this has been a creeping problem in Rockstar's games that in some ways is worse than ever in this one because of the level of cinematic production and verisimilitude in, like, the graphics and things like that, in that what's the first thing you do in a mission? Well, you get on your horse and you ride with someone. And what is the actual player input there? It's very minimal, and they've made it more minimal than ever now because you can just throw the cinematic camera on and hold X, and you just listen to them talk. And it's basically a very, very long loading screen with dialogue on it, you know? And sometimes it just turns the cinematic camera on for you. And when you get there, what are you going to do? Well, if it's not shooting, it's usually a mostly scripted event where they are going to disable all possible controls that will, you know, allow you to do anything other than what they want you to do. And Arthur will move at the speed they want you to move, and he will have the options to do the things they want you to do with him. And if you do not do those things, either you will not progress, or they will just straight up throw you to a screen where it says, failed, you didn't do the thing. Fuck you for playing our game, which is what that feels like. And when you're through those parts, then there will be shooting, and the shooting is, in those big scenarios, the word for it is mindless. You need no strategy, you need very little thought, it is not challenging. I have ways I make it fun for myself, like I'm pretty good at getting headshots, and I like using the shotgun or the sawed-off shotgun because you just watch their heads explode. Like, they are primed for Undead Nightmare 2 with those head explosion physics in this game. And that can be kind of fun, but it is completely mindless. This is not, there's not even a combat puzzle mechanic to it because, you know, other than get in cover so you don't get shot to death, there's no strategy here. There's no, like, actively having to think about these things. It's just you shoot a lot of people until you're done shooting the people. And then when you're done with that, you ride away and you do what they want you to do. And that seems like such a weirdly divergent design choice from the rest of the game and the open world stuff, and where you really can, as a player, express yourself through the world. And I have found little ways to express myself through the campaign, like how I choose to grow Arthur's facial hair and what clothes I have him wear, and you can really fit that to the story, which is great, and I love that element of it, and you can do some role play. But it just feels like, I think Red Dead 2 feels like it is Rockstar being pulled in two directions, and one direction is a real serious overhaul of the foundation of their video game design. And they have not done that overhaul here. But it feels like they could. It feels like they want to in some ways. It feels like there are places where they're trying it. But ultimately, it is we are still in GTA 4 land. That is still the fundamental design aesthetic of Rockstar games. And it has not changed for over 10 years. In the narrative, I feel like they've grown so much, especially compared to the immediate predecessor, GTA 5, which is such a sophomoric game, and this is such a mature piece of storytelling. I still think it has its limitations. I still think, for the most part, Rockstar could not write a strong woman character who is not made masculine. If you put a fucking gun to their head, they just do not have that in their body. And, you know, at this point, I'm not expecting it. But, you know, there are limitations, but I think this game has some absolutely beautiful, nuanced character writing that gets to some really interesting points. I also think they trip over their own dick sometimes when they try to bring in, like, Native Americans and you know, people who have been freed from slavery. And they get into some of that in the second half of the game where it's like, you don't know what you're talking about. Shut up. This is bad. But for the most part, again, I think this feels so much more mature. And I guess I'm just at a point where I feel like the game is pulled in different directions. And part of it is that, you know, Rockstar is so stubborn in doing the things the way they've always done them and the way they want to do them. And there needs to be... This is not the full-throated evolution I was kind of thinking it might be after my first day or two with it last week. I guess that's where I'm at.
Yeah, and it's something that's interesting because for me, it does feel like that, but mostly because I haven't been playing the main story missions.
Yeah.
So it's like the stuff in the open world... Like, I've never, you know, been this involved in doing open world stuff in a Rockstar game. Like, usually, like, I kind of, with Red Dead Redemption 1, a little bit more, but it was just only, like, me doing the challenges and doing, like, all the bandit hideouts or whatever that, you know, like, the very, like, regimented, strict, like, this is the open world activities. You do these stranger missions, you do this set of challenges, and you do this thing, and then you go clear out all the bandit hideouts. And Red Dead Redemption 2 has, like, literally all of those things. It also has, again, like, some weird collectibles that are so just sort of like, I don't know why the fuck, why is there a lady looking for dinosaur bones, and why is there just like, as far as I know, no mechanism to help you find these random dinosaur bones that are like impossible to see? That's a bizarre thing. But that aside, like, all that stuff is in the game, but there's this whole other like layer of like tumult under it all, of just the NPCs and the like, what feels like must be like hundreds of different scenarios that they have created that are scenarios they have created. It's not just like the Far Cry thing of, we've made it so that, you know, birds will attack you every 5 minutes and there's just a bunch of patrolling like guards and bandits all over the place and that like they're setting shit on fire. And it's like, that's fun in Far Cry 3, 4 and kind of fun in Far Cry 5. And that's sort of like that open world just nonsense that happens. It's not that. It's design scenarios with like individual NPCs that have unique dialogue, that have like a specific thing going on that you just almost never really encounter duplicates of. And it's like that layer of it to me has so changed the way that I interact with the world and is the main reason why I've kind of not really done any of the story missions past a certain point, is because it's just like I'm so lost in that. And I'm very curious to see how I'll take the story stuff once I get deeper into it. That I, like, entirely foresee a possibility that this is going to end up being, like, a Skyrim to me, where, because the other games that I've gotten this involved in the open world stuff, I have never actually finished. Like, I've never done the main story stuff because I just get so wrapped up in my own thing that it just becomes kind of almost impossible to keep on playing the game past a certain point. So that's a possibility here. I have no idea.
But, and it's, yeah, like... I am so of multiple minds on this, because I also need to see how the game is going to wrap up. It's not that the story ever gets bad. I love the story in this game, I think. Again, seeing where it wraps up and stuff. I think it's definitely too long. It's much too long a game. It's fat around the middle, as every Rockstar game is. Again, not as fat around the middle as GTA 4, Red Dead 1, and GTA 5, but it is still bloated. But I'm also like, at the point where I am now, I feel like if this were condensed and focused, this is such an impactful story they're telling. I'm not sure it does go hand in hand with an open world. There's a part of me that thinks the best version of this campaign is a linear campaign that does not have an open world component. And that does not mean I don't want the open world of Red Dead 2 to exist. I'm just saying, like, for the story they've chosen to tell, it feels like the kind of thing Naughty Dog would tell really well. And it feels like Rockstar is kind of trying to do that, but tacked on to something that is an evolution of their open world design. And I just don't know if the two mesh. And I'm still working out my thoughts on this, but it's one of the ways I'm kind of conceiving of this at this point.
Yeah. One thing I'm very curious about is to see how like Red Dead Online will function and if that will have any of that NPC stuff. And I mean, I'm sure it will have NPCs in it. But because there are in GTA Online, but I'm curious to see if like the events in the world and that layer will exist in Red Dead Online, because that would be really interesting to me, to try to like merge some of that together a little bit. Because one thing I am like sitting here and thinking is like, I kind of wish there was just like a hardcore mode for Red Dead Redemption 2. I think I said this last week also, that just like really turned some of those knobs a little bit harsher, made so it's like you really needed to eat, like you really needed to sleep, like, and make that like experience of living in the world more a like in your face gameplay element. And just kind of ripped the story missions out of there. And maybe you still had the camp and some stuff related to the camp and the people in the camp, because I like all of that. But like, but to basically make a mode that more directly, you know, encouraged or like demanded the way that I'm playing the game. And I think that would be, you know, a really cool, obviously like probably a lot of game design you'd have to do to get that to actually function and be something that people would want to do. But it's something that like, that I would love to see them do, because they have the resources. And it feels like, you know, open world games have been at this point for a while of like this interesting crossroads of so many different directions they can go in. And I think one thing we're identifying is that Rockstar kind of wants to go in two different directions at the same time. You've been playing in one of those directions and I've been playing in the other direction. And it's like what you've been saying, it does kind of feel incompatible, because it feels hard for me to play the game the way I want to play and also play the story missions at the same time. Because the story missions are too involved, I have to go way out of my way to do them. I like having them kind of there as this pressure to know that there's another thing I can do that kind of pushes things forward to another level. But other than that, like, I don't feel drawn to them in any strong way.
And it creates decisions like, let's fast travel, for instance. The fact that there is no built-in fast travel from, like, your map or something. Like, you can do it if you upgrade your base enough back at your camp, but you cannot fast travel while out in the world unless you go, like, buy a train ticket. But even then, that's a whole involved thing, right?
Yeah, I've never bought a train ticket.
Okay, but that kind of thing makes 100% sense for the open world stuff. And, again, that sense of verisimilitude of making you feel a part of the world and forcing you to travel and have these natural adventures. If you are going through and playing the campaign, it can get really fucking frustrating when there is, like, enough stuff that you want to go do, and it's just the sheer distances you have to travel to do it and the speed at which you are allowed to do it, because everything moves so slowly as a base speed in this game. And it's... there's just things like that where I just feel this push and pull of, like, this decision makes sense over here, and I'm not sure it makes sense over here. So I don't know. I'm not sure where my thoughts are settling on this game, except I do want to stress how much I like Arthur Morgan, how much I like this story on the whole, even though I think it has some problems, and as I said, I think it trips over its own dick in a few places. We will talk about how this game views its characters in relation to Native Americans. Ooh, boy, it's not good. But like, you know, I still like all of that so much, and I guess I wish the game around it worked to those strengths better. And I think it could do that and play to the open world strengths, but I'm just not sure. You know, there's so many, like, if you're just playing through the main campaign stuff, you kind of can just ignore most of the survival mechanics going on in the game. And I feel like that's also a problem, because I think you could make a version of this game where the campaign missions employ all of that so much more. Like, you know, a good comparison is Breath of the Wild, which is a simpler version of all of this. But the result of that is that you don't get to skip interacting with a lot of the things in that game. You learn all the interlocking systems, and you work with them, and it all works in tandem, and it's a very tight design. Whereas this is broad enough, and because it does not have that kind of hardcore element as you're talking about, like, you can just sort of ignore a lot of what is in this game. Like, I forget things like hunting and fishing are in it, and I wonder if there are other ways they could play on all of that. It's a very big behemoth of a game, and it's kind of unwieldy, and it's fascinating. It's definitely fascinating to play. I'm just not sure what it is at this point.
Like, one of the things that is interesting about me, to like, this is like, will be probably a much bigger conversation to have once we're both done with the game, because I think it's a very interesting comparison between this and Breath of the Wild. But, you know, like, I did not like Breath of the Wild that much. And part of the reason is I think that it was so narrow in its design in so many ways. Like, in some ways, its design was very big and allowed you, like, all these different physics elements to play with each other. But I never found the, like, window into, like, that expressiveness in that game that it felt like a lot of people found. And for me, like, Red Dead Redemption 2, while it does not funnel you to this playstyle, it accommodates the playstyle that I want from it, which Breath of the Wild just didn't really at any point. And that's something that's, like, interesting to me about this game. That, like, if I, like, trying to play Breath of the Wild the way that I would want to play it and, like, make it the game more for me, it just didn't really support it in any way because it more kind of wanted you to do things in a sort of a more specific way, and it didn't support this wide range of different things that are, like, mostly useless in Red Dead Redemption 2, but are there. And that's, you know,
but I think
it feels like two different design philosophies.
I get that, but it also leads to inevitable downsides where, like, again, yeah. The controls in this game are fucking garbage. I will go to my grave saying that, because if I have to stand over the fucking bed and go triangle, no, don't open the drawer, no, try, no, R1, go to, no, try, god damn it, let me fucking sleep. And it's like that is constant in this game where, like, one button does so many commands, and just trying to do the basic interactions with the game sometimes can be maddening. Like, I remember earlier, I had slept at a saloon, and I was coming out of the saloon, and I just wanted to get on my horse, and I wanted to get on my horse and go buy some hair tonic because I'm trying to get my beard to grow, which is very hard past level 7. I don't know if you've hit that, Sean, but...
I'm clean shaven.
Oh, okay.
Arthur Morgan does not grow this fucking beard.
Oh, no, to me, Arthur Morgan with clean shaven is weird. He has to have a fucking grizzly man beard, to me.
You need to shave the beard so you can see the beard grow. The beard is meaningless if there's no zero
point. Oh, you have not seen Hobo Arthur, at my point in the story.
I have. I saw that tweet you made.
I love Hobo Arthur. He's my... But I have gone through other points. I had him do a Walter White look for a while where he was completely bald with a goatee. And it was great. He looked... If they did a movie adaptation of this, it would be Bryan Cranston. But anyway, trying to get my hair to grow. And I go out to get on... So I wanted to go buy some hair tonic. I was in Rhodes, and the general store is far enough that I was going to ride my horse over there. So I'm going to get on my horse. I press triangle to get on my horse. There was a guy standing by my horse, and for some reason, pressing the triangle command knocked him to the floor and started choking him. And I got wanted, and now I can't do anything in Rhodes, and I have to run the fuck away, and I can't come back for a while. And, like, it's constantly doing things like that to me, where just unexpected things happen. I can't quite do what I want to do. You know, we'll walk around, and, like, if you try to, you know, get your horse off-road at all, it's just going to run into shit, and it's going to constantly collapse over stuff. And, again, there's so many things going on in the game that I feel like if you're playing it one way, maybe it's great for you. If you're playing another way, it feels like so much of it exists to frustrate you. And I don't know how I feel about all of that.
Yeah, like, I will agree that, you know, and this is a fucking... tale as old as time for video games that have, like, a bunch of objects in them. But yes, trying to select the specific object you want is a fucking bitch in this game. Like, that is definitely for sure. It's just, like, I'm so used to dealing with that in video games at some point that I, like, kind of forget about it. Because it's just so many fucking games do this. And yeah, so it's, like, that's very frustrating. But I continue to really like the controls in most ways. Because it specifically is actually stuff like... riding your horse off-road and in the forest is fucking hard in this game, and it feels like it should be. Because it's like, you're not supposed to ride horses at full
gallop.
Then
why did they build
the
forest? Like, at a certain point.
To hunt in! Like, there's
sometimes I want to get from point A to B, and I don't want to go on their really long, circuitous route. This is what I mean. One person's like, it's fun to go hunting, is another person's, the game is telling me to fuck myself.
Yeah, and it's the thing that, because it feels like we're, like, in the opposite... of the Breath of the Wild conversation.
Okay.
Where for me, in Breath of the Wild, I was like, the combat in this game is fucking bullshit because it just plays itself, and you didn't have that experience. And so for me, like, the horse being very difficult to manage in those really dense areas felt like a legitimate, like, game decision that I was like, it felt surprising to me that no game had done that before, because it was like, of course, like, it should be difficult. And it's like, you can do it, but you have to kind of really pay attention and manage your horse more, like, exactingly. And you can't go at a full gallop all the time. And it makes it so that, like, horse races through the woods or, like, trying to hunt in the woods is a, like, materially different experience than it is in the open plains. And it makes, like, those denser areas and, like, really rocky areas or really wooded areas feel very different, and you have to take the terrain into account, which is something that I'm sure, like, you know, if you're, like, in mainlining story mission stuff, might be frustrating, get in the way. But playing the game that I play, like, it provides this interesting friction to those sections of the map that give it, like, a specific identity that feels like, okay, like, when I'm here, this feels so different than when I'm, like, hunting bison out in the plains.
One note I will make on this is that another I don't think this is a spoiler, so I stop me if I start to say this and you think you don't want to know this. Where the majority of the game takes place, as at the point I am, which is very deep into the narrative, is not on open plains. It is not in the West. It is not in those areas. It is in Lemoyne, and it is in Saint Denis, and it is in, like, still to this point, you're so much on the eastern side of the map. It's all trees, and it's all swamps, and it's none of those, like, more western kind of areas. You have to go to those on your own. The story doesn't take you there. And so there's a lot of that where, like, again, if you're playing through the main campaign and you just want to get to the goddamn story mission on your horseback, and sometimes you want to take a shortcut, and then it's like, oh, fuck, my horse is dead because I went over a goddamn rock, and this game is, and it's like, and I get to those points and I'm like, I get your academic exercise here, Rockstar, but instead of making your cerebral point here, I'd like to just play the game. And I guess that's where I feel about the controls sometimes, is like, I get why Arthur Morgan walks inhumanly slow at his base speed through town, but I'd like to just play the game. And I guess that's where I come down on a lot of it in some of these ways.
And, like, and it is that, like, you know, bullshit thing, but for me it's like, that is the game. Like, yeah. The game is made by him moving slowly, and it taking a long time to go places is why I get sidetracked. If I could just speed across that world as, like, you know, super, super fucking quickly, I would have played a bunch more story missions, and I would be mainlining that story. But I would never have had that experience of, you know, being in that poker match and having that whole weird thing. I would never have found the woman off the side of the road that I stole her fucking shotgun and all this shit.
I get it. And this is a really interesting conversation to me. And I guess it just comes back to, like, what is the game? What is Red Dead Redemption 2? Is it the plot and story that they spent, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, well, I guess hundreds of millions would go into all of this, but, like, you know, that they wrote and directed and they're all meticulous about, or is it all the stuff you're talking about? Where do they overlap? Where don't they overlap? Is it possible for them? Like, I'd be very curious if you come out of this having, if you actually do finish the whole story, because I know what you mean about, like you have not finished, like, Skyrim, for instance, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you do that, and if you still love it the way you do now, that would mean you were able to reconcile all these things in a way I haven't been able to. And I'm curious if that's even possible, and if it isn't, does that say something bad about the game? Does that say something good about the game? Does that say something good about the way you played it, but not the way I played it, which feels like more of the default way? I don't know. It's a very confusing set of questions.
It's the thing that's a bitch about talking about video games, particularly video games that are as broad and have as many possibilities as this, is that, like, it's not like watching a movie or reading a book where everybody has, you know, broadly speaking, the same experience. Like, the movie does not transform physically, whether if you watched it or I watched it, whereas the game is, like, actually different when I played it. Like, the data on the game is different in my game than your game, right?
Right.
So it is...
This is just, you know, stark, is what I mean.
Yeah, it's more stark than most games, but, you know, it's... You know, again, it's kind of like with Breath of the Wild. We had, like, polar opposite experiences playing that game, like, partially from our approaches, partially from, like, what we enjoy, what we were expecting, like, what we wanted to find, that kind of stuff. And this has a similar element. One note I want to make on the controls, just to, like, again, to emphasize, like, where I'm at with the game. My biggest quibble with the controls is that if you have a gun drawn and you have fired a shot but have not cocked it again yet and are not aiming it and you pull the trigger, he cocks it and fires immediately. I don't like that. He should cock. I want to be able to fire my repeater rifle and then put it down and then cock it without aiming, because that's cool. And that's like, I have shot you and you are down and I don't need to aim and get ready for the next shot, but, like, kind of prepare the next one. Like, I like that little extra bit that they make that for most people, they're like, of course I want you just to, like, that's why I'm pulling the triggers. I want to keep on firing. I'm like, no, never. Like, I wish I had to pull the trigger fucking four fucking times when I had dual revolvers out to fire two shots and cock both guns. Like, it's bullshit that it auto-cocks for me when I'm doing dual revolvers. The game shouldn't do that. Like, that's... Like, I want the game to lean more into that side of things, which is probably not what most people want, is how I feel.
Probably not. Considering I am still confused by the entire cocking system, because sometimes, like...
Oh, it's so good.
It makes no sense to me in large shootouts, where sometimes I will fire, and it will fire, and then I am able to cock it, and then fire again, and sometimes I will fire... And he will just do two shots, and I pulled the trigger once, and I'm not sure what's happening, and it's all over the place, and, I mean, it's a lot. The controls are so inconsistent, and they never do the exact same thing twice, and it's very unpredictable, and again, it's like it gives control to the player in some places, and then in mission design, it often just takes it away from the player, so I don't know. This is a weird game. Anything else to say about Red Dead 2 before we move on to Doctor Who?
I like it. I'm looking forward to... seeing what Chapter 3 has to offer, because when I say I got to Chapter 3, I mean I literally got to Chapter 3, shaved my beard, put on some different clothes, and saved the game of life.
Nice.
I put it down because I needed to watch Doctor Who.
All right. So let's talk about this week's Doctor Who, the Tsunaraga Conundrum. What was it?
The
Tsunaraga Conundrum.
Surunga?
Yes.
No, I think you wrote it down on the outline. It's the Surunga Conundrum.
It's Tsunaraga, but they said it's Surunga.
Is it really Tsunaraga?
Yeah, you can look at it here, because that's an exact transcription. I remember seeing that in the episode. They say it differently than it is seemingly spelled. But, yeah, in any case, this episode, I don't even know what to say anymore, Sean. It's okay. It's fine. I think in some ways this is probably the most solid episode of the season, just from, like, a pacing perspective and a just general writing perspective, but also, like, good God, there is no ambition here. There is... The biggest theme in this episode is the theme of fatherhood, with the man giving birth and Ryan thinking about his father, but that has... could not have anything less to do with the main threat of the episode, or what the Doctor is going through, or what the other characters are thinking about. So this is another theme-free episode of Doctor Who. It is a largely ambition-free episode of Doctor Who. It is the maybe most overstuffed of our overstuffed episode of Doctor Who, because there are 10 full speaking characters, all of whom are trying to get weight in this episode, which is ridiculous. The monster is Stitch from Lilo and Stitch, and that's weird. I don't know. It's whatever. This is easily the worst season of Doctor Who it's had since returning in 2005.
Yeah. It's something where I agree with you that this is probably the most competent, but this is probably the least I've enjoyed one of these episodes since 2.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of, even if, like, 3 and 4 are not great, there are parts of it that, like, I kind of enjoyed, particularly at the beginning. And I enjoyed the first 10 minutes or whatever this episode with when the Doctor's running around with the guy.
Yes,
and
I want to talk about those.
Basically completely forget that the fucking companions exist, and I'm like, oh my God, right, that's one of the major problems, is they have no idea what to do with these characters, and this is the only substantive chunk of time we've had with just the Doctor doing something, and we don't, like, have to have them be meaningless characters involved, that it's like... It really put into stark relief for me just how big of a mistake the three companion thing is with the approach that they've decided to go, which is the exact same structure as that what Davies and Moffat used. It's just that their structure was designed for the Doctor, a primary companion, and then maybe another secondary character like a Rory or something. And they're like, we're going to use that exact same format, but we're going to put three full-time companions on there at the same time, but not write a character for one of them. And not know how to manage them at all. So it's like, this episode has probably better pacing and that kind of stuff, and it doesn't fall apart so utterly in the end. Like, the ending's fucking messy as shit still, but it's not... It doesn't, like, neglect to end the way that the Arachnids one did. It's not offensive in the way that a lot of the Rosa kind of stuff was, particularly, like, for the, like, weird American's perspective. And then, you know, it doesn't go completely, like, sideways, like all the weird TARDIS stuff, or, like, for just forgetting about the race component of the Ghost Monument. So it's, like, doesn't fall apart so completely, but I think I'm just so kind of fed up with how dull this version of Doctor Who chooses to be for so long that it's, like, I found it much more difficult to enjoy most of this episode, and I kind of fell off of it after the first 10 minutes, as opposed to the first, like, half or so, which is where I was riding along for the other episodes for a while.
I could barely hold my attention on this one. Like, I was, yeah, like, checking Twitter and just... I took a lot of notes because I was bored. And here's the thing. I was extra disappointed in this one because I actually did, like, the first 10 or 15 minutes a lot. And what it was is, when they took Jodie Whittaker away from the crappy side characters they have right now, because I don't think, other than Bradley Walsh, I like Bradley Walsh and his character, but Ryan is utterly schizophrenic at this point as a character. He has no certifiable, like, single characteristic. He's a new angst every week. That's what they've done with him. And the angst from the previous week never returns. Remember when he had, like, what was it? Dysphagia?
Dyspraxia. Dyspraxia?
Yeah, that's not a thing anymore. But his...
Yeah, that has not come up since episode 2.
No, so they give him a new angst every week. Yaz is still not a character, and I like Bradley Walsh, but I don't remember his character's name. Graham. There we go.
Graham.
Like the cracker. Graham. But anyway, Graham. You take Jodie Whittaker away from those characters where she... And this clarified a lot for me, because when she has 3 companions, and none of those companions are fleshed out, and when she has no relationship with any one of them, she has a relationship with the group, but no one-on-one individual relationships with all of them. The way, like, I could tell you, even from not having seen all of the serials, what the First Doctor's relationship is with Susan, Ian, Barbara individually, and as a group, right? That's what you would need to have. They don't have that. So she has to be in, you know... Magic School Bus Lady, Mrs. Frizzle mode, all the time, being the leader of the group, all the time when she's with them, because she has no individual relationships where she can be vulnerable. In the first 15 minutes of this episode, they give Whittaker so much more to do, because she goes off with this captain dude, they abandon the rest of the cast, it's just the Doctor and this other person in a leadership position, and she has to go through this arc of realizing, I'm being selfish and ego-driven here, thinking I need to get back to my TARDIS, and I'm not putting, like, the needs of this ship before the needs of, like, my narrow concern here. And when they get to that moment where the captain calls her on that, and she comes around, it's the best moment Whittaker has had to play since some of the stuff in the premiere. Like, she's a person in this episode for a little bit, because she gets to be with another character and show a little bit of vulnerability and show... another side to the Doctor, and then they kill that dude, and then they put her back, and we realize, oh, there are, with the captain gone, there are 9 full speaking characters on this ship. We are going to try to simultaneously service all of them. The Doctor will be bouncing around like a ping pong ball against all of them, and the Doctor has to go back into follow the leader mode, where every, and it's also, I think, just directorially, like, everything she's asked to play is the same. It's all directed the same, where she is breathlessly running around and being eager about everything, and oh my god this, and oh my god that, and you're going to do this, and you're going to do that, and I'm going to inspire you over here. And it is just the most one-dimensional characterization a Doctor has ever had on this show. Like, easily. Like Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy's early episodes, rough, whatever, I think they're much clearer characterizations for the Doctor.
Well, I would... For Sylvester McCoy, maybe not
okay,
so much.
I haven't seen those.
Time in the Ronnie, he is a totally different character.
Okay, but by his fifth, Paradise by his fifth story, what would you say?
Oh, yes. No, yes. By his fifth story. I mean, actually, I think specifically by his fifth episode, which is when Paradise Towers begins. Yes.
Okay.
Like, he starts, he's way more there than what they've got here.
That's my point. We're 5 stories in, and I realize that's only 5 episodes, but if Jodie Whittaker does 3 seasons like every other modern Doctor, we're a sixth of the way through her run.
Yeah.
If you want to all be depressed right now. We're a sixth of the way, potentially, through her run if she does 30 episodes, which is 3 10-episode seasons. This is 5. That is, if I'm doing my math right, 1/6, and nothing. There is not a character here. And I'm not sure I'm even at the point where I still think it's a good performance, not because of anything she's doing, but because there's no room for it to be a good performance. There's room for it to be a manic performance and a, like, energetic performance, but not a character-driven performance. And when you get those 10 minutes early on where it's her and this captain dude, and she gets to act, she gets to genuinely, like, stretch this character's legs out, I just saw this glimpse of the parallel world where someone else is writing Doctor Who, and she is being the great Doctor it's very clear she could be. And then you get back to just the manic, you know, running around mode, and there's nothing. And you have all these characters, because it's a 50-minute episode, and you have 10 fucking characters, and not a goddamn one of them can be properly serviced. The one who comes across strongest is probably the pregnant dude, and there's some nice writing there, I guess. But also, again, like... If that's the core of your episode, why is this not an episode in some way about fatherhood? But it's not. It can't be. None of, like, the Doctor never even interacts with that side of the story.
Yeah, and that the pregnant guy is like squarely set as the B plot. Yes. Like that's the B plot of the episode. I agree that it's like at some point it feels like it's become the A plot because so much of the focus and actual like attention is kind of put on it, in like in the best stuff of the episode past the first 10 minutes is all focused around that because it's the only place that has any real emotional content. Because I think most of the emotional stuff around the captain lady and her android and her brother is just like, I don't know what's going on in half that shit. I can, like, a guy is pregnant and giving birth, like, that's weird and goofy, and I understand this, like, the emotional stakes involved, and at least Ryan has some sort of thing related to this. There's, like, something there.
Oh, I, with the, like, the general lady, the brother, and the android, at the point where, like, she's dying and they're, like, really in close and he says, oh, there's so much I wanted to tell you, I thought, like, oh, I must have misheard. That's not her brother. That's her lover. Because that's how it's played.
Me too.
And I'm like, and then I'm like, oh, wait, no. It is her brother. Like, and I just threw up my hands, like, I don't know. This is so dull. I can't keep track of any of this.
I just had this realization. Did they even show that lady die? Or is she, did they just cut
they
back
died,
if
she
she's
died off
already
screen,
dead?
Yeah.
Fucking shit. Okay, that's something to come back to is, like, this, like, while this one doesn't have, like, the same kinds of editing issues that the other episodes had that we talked about, this has some fucking weird shit in it that, like, really confused me. But I want to stick with the companion stuff for a little bit because it reminded me of something, and I love that we both, because, like, you basically hit the exact thing that I realized, because I also wrote some handwritten notes on this episode.
Oh, nice.
Because I was doing some homework after I watched it, and I was, like, writing stuff out by hand and couldn't stop thinking about the different bullshit, pieces of bullshit in this episode, and I just need to write something. I have this piece of paper and a pen, so I'm just going to write this by hand. And we both hit on the same thing of, like, this episode put into such stark relief that the major issue here for me is the companions and them not building the relationship with the companions properly. It reminded me of a line that Stephen Moffat had in one of the last interviews he did on the Doctor Who YouTube channel. You can go and find, they did like basically three long videos, each about 30 minutes long, where the woman who was sort of in charge of the Doctor Who YouTube stuff then, I don't know if she's still there or not.
I don't think she is, and it makes me sad because she was so cool. I loved the fan
show. Yeah, she was great. I loved her. And she was really good at interviewing Moffat and asked some really interesting questions. And one of the answers he gave in response to a question about, like, some fans who don't like the Clara stuff felt that Clara was too important a character in the show and too important a character to the Doctor, and, like, gave examples of, like, her going back and listen. And the one that I really agree with is the fucking stupid shit at the beginning of Name of the Doctor, where she, like, leads the first Doctor to her TARDIS. Like, that's a dumb one. But Moffat's answer to that was really well considered and, like, highlights for me one of the major problems with this one is he said, well, of course I made her the most important person to the Doctor at that point in time, because what is the story if she's not? What is the story of the Doctor hanging out with this lady that, like, he kind of likes? It's like, of course he, like, and he's like, that's what they did with Rose. Like, that's the thing that Davies hit on is, like, you need to make the companion really important. Like, I think we both know that, you know, in season two, like, the stuff with Rose got, like, really kind of misaligned. But it would, in season one, it was right on. And since then, there has been such a clear, strong relationship and connection between the companion and the Doctor. And it's like, you know, that Rose was in love with him. Martha was in love with him, but, like, it was this sort of unrequited love. Donna saw him as this, like, ticket to go, like, live this larger-than-life life and see everything that's out there and get the life that she feels she's deserved.
He called her his best friend.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Like, and Amy saw the Doctor as her childhood friend, like, who came back and, like, her imaginary friend all grown up, that could, again, like, show her the wonders of the universe. Clara took a little bit for Clara because of the weird season seven stuff, but, you know, Clara both sees him as this, like, incredible companion and powerful friend, but also kind of like Donna, this gateway into this much larger world that she can't leave behind. And then Bill sees him as a teacher.
Yeah.
And, like, all of those are really powerful, strong relationships, and the Doctor reciprocates them most of the time and sees them, you know, as equals and someone that he really cares for and nurtures, and they have this powerful mutual trust companionship relationship. In this season of Doctor Who, we have three companions. None of them have any sort of relationship with the Doctor at all. I don't know what Graham sees the Doctor as. I don't know what Ryan sees the Doctor as. I certainly do not know what Yaz sees anything as, because at this point, another thing this episode made clear is that Yaz is the one that got saddled with the companion role of asking all the dumb questions, because all she does in this whole episode is someone will say a thing and she'll be like, oh, what, antimatter? I heard about that, what's that? And it's like all she does is ask fucking questions to explain shit. She has no motivations, no character, and none of them have any relationship with the Doctor at all, which means when you have this scenario where you have a really clear, like, A plot and B plot that almost never intersect past the first act of the episode, the A plot being the Pating I have written here, the Tasmanian Devil, the Gremlin.
It's Stitch from Lilo and Stitch, almost
yeah,
to Stitch. A T.
Whichever flavor you want, it's that thing. That's the A plot, or should be. It's the plot you're introduced with. It's the plot that kills that dude, sets everything off. But then you have this B plot with the alien guy who's pregnant, and those two things are so separate that at points it felt like they were like from two different shows that happened to be shot on the same fucking set, because they had nothing to do with each other, and the Doctor wasn't even a part of it. And it was like, this is like Ryan and Graham have a TV show over here. The Doctor has found some random lady named Yaz that's going to ask her a bunch of questions so she can explain shit, and never the twain shall meet. And it felt like this bizarre scenario of, like, why are you even telling this story? Why is this even a story to tell? It's like violating maybe the first lesson taught in any creative writing class, which is, when do you start the story? And it's like, it feels like we should have started this story 5 years from now, when these people are friends at some point and have a relationship with each other, because right now they don't. Mm-hmm. And it's that's not a fucking TV show. I don't know what that is.
And again, like, and you know, you went through all the, like, modern Doctor Who companions, but we could go all day doing this on classic Who companions, which...
Yeah. It would be too long.
There are bad ones, obviously. You know, like, Perry is a pretty obvious example of, like, what's the relationship, right? Although there are points where Perry is very well used, like Caves of Androzani. But, like, you know, someone in my mentions, because I've had a lot of conversations about Doctor Who on Twitter lately, and one of them was someone mentioning, like Arachnids in the UK, and they were like, God, episodes like The Green Death and Planet of the Spiders are so much better than this. And I said, I don't even know how you mention those in the same breath, because The Green Death is an all-timer, and Planet of the Spiders is a really good regeneration story. And it made me think of the end of The Green Death and the Third Doctor going away from Joe. And I'm like, and I know this is an unfair comparison, because that's one of the best companion exits, but how far are we from that? Like, I would feel no emotion, and I don't think the Doctor would either, if in the next episode it began with her pulling a lever on the TARDIS and a trapdoor opened and Graham, Ryan, and Yaz got sucked out into the blackness of space and died. And she'd be like, huh, that was weird. Let's go find some better friends. Like, there'd just be nothing. There's no relationship. And whereas, you know, the best Doctor Who, and not even, you don't even have to go to the best, the middling Doctor companion relationships, like, let's go 10 and Martha or something like that, you know, or I don't know, what's another good, like, middling one from maybe classic Who?
Fuck, I'm trying to think of, I mean, any Fifth Doctor. Let's go with Turlough. Wait, no, we didn't do a Turlough episode. Let's go with Tegan.
Yeah, so Fifth Doctor and Tegan, you know, maybe not the best Doctor, maybe not the best companion, but it's like, when they're on screen together, you get a sense of the chemistry, how they go around the world together. Same with, like, Martha and Tan.
Like, at least Tegan has this, like, characterization of she is the wet blanket that doesn't want to be here and is, like, dragging every adventure down. It's a bad relationship, and that doesn't usually is not, like, a great character setup for a character in Doctor Who, but it is a fucking character relationship that is, like, defined and the actors play with
it. And you can run story drama through it, right? That's important. Yes. And there is no story drama you can run through these characters. And you know how I know that? Because they have not done an episode about these characters yet. We're halfway through the season. There is no other companion where there has not, at this point, been an episode that is in some way about the companions. That has not happened yet. It just hasn't. And, like,
we even had the episode with Yaz's fucking family, and somehow it's not about that.
No.
It still blows my mind.
And it's like, so they are so incidental, because every week we come in with a four-person ensemble, which, you know, not necessarily big for, like, I don't know, a crime procedural or something, but for Doctor Who, that's a kind of anthology-esque sort of show. that is very episodic and goes to different places each week, that's a big cast. And on top of that big cast, Chris Chibnall has layered a giant supporting cast pretty much every week. I guess you would say the Ghost Monument was a smaller supporting cast, but it's still two more people. You have at a minimum six speaking characters you have to run an episode through every time, and that means in every episode you have no time to do anything with the three companions we already have, because you have to introduce and have full arcs and resolutions for multiple speaking guest characters. And when you're doing all of that, but you also have these three companions, they can't actually be established. So what you have is just a bunch of gobbledygook, and the Doctor is in the middle gluing it all together, but she can't become a character because she's so busy running between all the factions and being, you know, Mrs. Frizzle, like, come on, kids, let's go. And that's kind of all she's gotten to do. It's really baffling to me. I don't know how you write five episodes not understanding these core, like, I didn't think these were in question. Like, bad Doctor Who gets this. You know?
Yeah.
Like, this is a different kind of problem than I've ever seen this show have. The Twin Dilemma does a better job handling its guest characters and the Doctor-companion relationship than this one does. And, you know, let us all remind you, that's the one that starts with the Doctor choking Perry.
Yes, but that episode that also has, like, the Doctor having the whole bit about how he wants to go become a hermit on some mountain and meditate to, like, make up for that and figure out who he is, which is more character depth than they have ever allowed Jodie Whittaker to have.
Yes.
It's like, it's so baffling. And when you're looking at the character relationships, it is like, going back to the fucking Ryan and Graham thing, it's so strange to me that, like, the only character relationship we have in the show so far is the one between Ryan and Graham. That's it. That's the only one that is, like, of any emotional substance or anything. That, like, not even, like, achieved emotional substance, like ambitioned emotional substance, like emotional substance that you're even going for. There isn't even an attempt to build any emotional substance in any other dynamic of the relationship between four people in your main cast. The only one attempted is between Ryan and Graham. And I like that one decent enough because I like Graham quite a bit. But it's like, how do you have a show called Doctor Who and the only fucking character relationship attempted on it is the one between Ryan and fucking Graham? Why isn't it a show about this elderly dude, or like older white British guy, trying to raise this, you know, his sort of like adopted step grandson, who's this younger black kid from a totally different generation who he's not even related to by blood? Like, that sounds like a pretty good character drama show, movie, whatever. I would fucking watch that if it was done well and it was these actors. Like, they'd do a good job. That's not what this fucking show is, though, and there's no room to actually do that relationship justice, and that relationship has nothing to do with going into space, it has nothing to do with the Doctor as a character, it has nothing to do with anything that Doctor Who is about, other than, like, they make the, like, brief refrain at the end of the last episode of Bradley Walsh being like, oh, I want to, like, run away, and, like, I can't just sit in that house with my grief. Like, really well-delivered little line he had, but it's, like, not touched on in this. His emotional situation does not exist in this episode at all. It's only Ryan. Ryan's the only one that has any sort of emotional anything in this episode, and that's it. It's like, you can't do that. You have to balance all the characters, at least most of the time, and you need to find some sort of relationship. And by the end of this 10-episode season, we should very easily, ideally, or like, not even just ideally, like at the bare minimum level of quality, you should be able to identify what relationship does each person have with any other person.
It's hilarious that you have to, like, map this out. That, like, yes, in a piece of fictional storytelling with characters, you should know how the characters feel about each other. Like, I can't believe that's a problem I don't know if I've seen before in any, I'd have to think what pieces of fictional media I know of that have that problem.
Yeah, that aren't just like, you know, some like random student film or something that's like you just stumbled upon on YouTube or some bullshit. Yeah, it's like, and the most galling thing about it is we only have one of those, really. I mean, I guess it's like the Doctor sort of vaguely cares about all these people, but that's not really a relationship. So you only have the one with Ryan and Graham. But at least with the Doctor, you have the, like, oh, like, I at least kind of care about these people. Yaz has almost none, even, like, the most is, like, she and Ryan were friends in school.
And other people think they should be fucking, but they don't have the chemistry and they don't seem like they want to fuck. But other people always assume they're fucking.
Because it's the kind of thing where, you know, they have that one heart-to-heart that comes the fuck out of nowhere in this episode between Ryan and Yaz, where Ryan talks about his dad walking out on him and him seeing his mom die, which is one of the notes I wrote, which is, quote, "How did your mom die?" Which is just like a, why did you ask this question in the middle of this crisis we're having? This is very random, Yaz. But he could have had that conversation with any other character. Yeah. As long as you established some sort of, like, something of like, oh, I had this tragedy, we're stuck together in this tragedy, let me get this out of you. The way that, like, you know, off the top of my head, Rings of Akatin, you have the scene where Clara and the little girl, and she has this heart-to-heart with the little girl about her family, Clara's family, and it's like, there you go. Like, you did, it could be any character. You just have to do some basic justification for why, in the stressful situation, they would have, like, talk about something emotional to them. And you could have any character do that. Yaz being the character didn't matter at all. And it's like, that shouldn't be the case.
Yeah.
Particularly not at episode 5.
I will say that conversation was more motivated than the other, like, Ryan is angsty moments, because it did come after him seeing the father thinking about whether or not he wanted the baby. That, at the very least, is a motivated, like, this is a guy thinking about abandoning his child. Ryan was abandoned. Okay, it's very basic. It's not the best writing in the world, but it's something. And it's one of those scenes where I could see that plucked out and put into a more competent episode of Doctor Who and being a very powerful moment if the last 4 episodes had made, like, Ryan and Yaz two people who share things with each other or something, you know? But that's not the relationship.
Yeah. And it's something where, like, you're right that the first part of the conversation is set up about the dad abandoning him. The part that's the most inexplicable is when she just goes, "How did she die?" And it's like, "How did your mom die?" And it's like, fucking what?
Like, it feels like,
it felt like
someone,
such a brief of confidence or something. Like, what the fuck are you, what are you asking me? What?
Yeah. It's like someone, you know, I guess it would be Chris Chibnall, wrote, like, the character Bible this season. And, like, here's all the thing, all the backstory of these characters. Here's all their traits. Now, here, I'm going to give this to my writing assistant. I'm going to have them put it through a shredder, and we're going to draw character traits out of a hat each episode, and we're going to, put this character trait into this episode, and we're going to put this piece of backstory into this episode. And it's not going to relate to the episode, it's just that we drew the mom died for episode 5, so in episode 5, he has to talk about how his mom died.
Yep.
It's very strange. All right, Sean. What the fuck is with all the pop culture references this season? Because...
yeah, it was a thing where, like, when they did the Banksy joke, it was like, oh, that's pretty funny. And then they've done that, like, every single episode.
Yes, this is the thing that they've done. In lieu of actually giving the Doctor a character or having... or asking Jodie Whittaker to, like, project the age of the Doctor the way, like, Matt Smith did a lot in his, you know, early days in the role, what they do is they have the Doctor name drop constantly. The Doctor always has a name drop in every episode to be like, I've done this with a historical figure. And it's like, okay, you really, after 55 years of Doctor Who, you can't come up with anything more creative to, like, give a sense of the character's time travel than she name drops Amelia Earhart or something like that? Whatever. But they also have a lot of pop culture references. So the Doctor here, and this is within, these two things are subsequent cuts. Like, we cut from one of these references to the next. And the first is the Doctor referencing Hamilton and how much she loves Hamilton, and she's seen all 900 casts, and we cut to Graham talking about how he is ready for this pregnancy because he's watched all of Call the Midwife. Now, the Call the Midwife joke was at least kind of funny on an island, because I liked how Bradley Walsh, like, delivered the joke and how he, like, he kind of made it into this thing of, like, this was weirdly good preparation for this. But, like, going back-to-back with the Hamilton reference, it's just like, why? Why do we have all these pop culture references? Why do we have all, like, the Trump references last week? Why are you dating Doctor Who? Like, Doctor Who generally does not engage that directly with, like, outside culture. And it probably shouldn't, given what the show's about, you know? Like, this isn't Family Guy. I'm not sure why you're doing this. It's not horrible, but it's bizarre.
Yeah, it's, like... RTD did a little bit of that, particularly in season 1 with, like, the Big Brother stuff, but at least it was, like, I didn't love that it was a part of the plot, but at least it was a part of the plot.
Yes.
So it was, like, you know, you couldn't deny it because then the episode itself literally couldn't exist. Here it's like, it just feels unnecessary. And it's also something with, like, the name-dropping thing. That's something that, like, each Doctor does a little bit here and there. And here it's, like, so much more than almost any other Doctor. The only other Doctor that did a bunch of it, and this is obviously only in the audio stuff, is the Eighth Doctor. But in the Eighth Doctor, they make it a specific character trait that he does that really pisses Charlie off. Because she's, like, one, she either doesn't know who he's referencing because she's from the early 20th century, or she's just like, you fucking stop showing off, you asshole. Because, you know, the only reason why the Doctor's constantly name-dropping Earth people is that, like, she knows Earth people at all. It's like, like, I'm gonna talk about how I hung out with Picasso or, you know, fucking Montezuma or whoever, you know, and it's just always kind of needles her a little bit and it annoys her. It's like, it's a little funny character detail about their relationship together. A character relationship, the Eighth Doctor and Charlie, that is so a million miles above and beyond the most meager things that we've seen so far in these five episodes. It's atrocious.
It's almost funny to even connect those, because the Eighth Doctor and Charlie is like the qualitative polar opposite of where we are right now.
Yes.
So I don't know. That's that. I wrote in my notes, at least the Doctor did not have the monster slash antagonist brutally murdered this week, question mark. Which is true. I thought she might.
Yeah, it was very close.
Yeah.
It was very close, but he really enjoyed having the bomb explode inside of him. That might be my favorite part of the episode, is when the thing blows up inside of him. He, like, floats towards the camera and is, like, very happy. I'm like, oh, that's okay.
That was nice.
He seems satisfied.
Yeah. We talked about the theme of fatherhood and how it connects to nothing. The monster design, we gotta have a talk about this. My flippant tweet on this was, the monsters on this season of Doctor Who are like if someone only saw the Ferengi episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, decided that was the absolute highest bar episodic sci-fi villains could ever clear, and then thought it best to aim much, much lower than that on a weekly basis. Is that a fair assessment of the monsters so far this season, Sean?
Yes. Yeah. It's not been good. You know, you had Toothface Man, you had evil scarves and, like, incredibly generic robots in episode two. You had the time-traveling racists in episode three.
Racists in space.
Yeah, racists in space. Then you had giant spiders in episode four. So far the best, because they're just giant spiders. And it's like, you know, they're spiders. There you go. That's the thing. It's like, you can't fuck with a good thing. You know, yeah. It's like, it's not broken, don't fix it. Giant spiders, I'll get behind that. And then this one, it is just the most just, like, nothing little monster. Like you said, it's Stitch. It's, like, it's a really bad monster design. And it's also just,
it's
such a waste of a fucking plot of Doctor Who. Because I have never seen a Gremlin story done in Doctor Who. You know, like, horror at 20,000 feet or whatever. It's one of those. You've seen them in any, if you ever watched any cartoon, cartoons have a bunch of these fucking Gremlin stories. Like, a bunch of Looney Tunes cartoons have them. About, you know, being, for actual Gremlin, like, folklore or whatever, it's about airplanes, but it being about a spaceship is fine, and some little monster that's just fucking with the ship. That's what the setup was, 12 minutes or whatever it is into the episode. After that dude dies, and you see this little monster, the design wasn't great, but I was like, okay, I can get behind a Gremlin thing, and then they don't do that plot. They just don't. They just decide, we'll just have this monster here. Now we're going to focus on the male pregnancy thing for almost the rest of the episode, and then occasionally cut back to this monster and just have a virtually incomprehensible plot line, like, solving this whole monster thing, and just the bomb and all this shit, and it's like, and that's just is done. It's like, how did you not even, you didn't even do it. Like, I don't even know if Chris Chibnall understood that he was referencing, like, a piece of old folklore about gremlins fucking with machines and airplanes and boats and stuff. He just, like, ended up quoting this piece of pop culture entirely without knowing or something, because he just didn't do that story, and it blew my mind that he didn't do it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all true. I also would note that this episode starts out very dour and serious, and that's part of why I liked the first 10 to 15 minutes, is they were pretty tonally consistent. And then the gremlin gets introduced, it gets very wacky for about 5 minutes, yeah. And then it ping-pongs between wackiness and soberness for the rest of the runtime, and never picks a tone. So,
yep.
I don't know. What is this episode? Who knows? But, yeah, I think that probably about does it. I don't have anything else to say about this
one. No, I want to run down a couple of my notes, Jonathan. My notes are not full ideas. They're just like sort of snippets. The first one is the most important one. Jonathan, what is the conundrum in the Saranga conundrum?
How do we fill 50 minutes of screen time this week on Doctor Who?
Right, because there's no conundrum. There's no... What? Why is it called this?
That sounds like a Star Trek episode title where they would like... A fun-loving alien would give them a puzzle to solve.
Yeah, it's either a fun-loving alien gives them a puzzle to solve, or there's some, like, impossible naval battle space, like, maneuver.
It would be like if the Corbomite maneuver never referenced the Corbomite maneuver. Right?
Exactly, yeah. It's just like, what is the... Like, I get the ship, the name of the ship, the Saranga thing. Like, okay, what's the conundrum? Like, is the conundrum how do you get this little monster off the ship? Because that's not a conundrum! That's just not, like, that's not what, I cannot count that. Is, yeah, the conundrum is how do you have four main characters on a TV show and have only one relationship? Okay, then, and then here's, I have now just a couple of, because I already did the How Did Your Mother Die thing from Yaz. We covered that one.
How Did Your Mother Die is the sad spinoff of how I Met Your Mother.
Yeah, that'd be a good show. It's like, it just, you know, it's 10 seasons. When you get to the end and find out how the mom died, it's really great. So then I want to have a brief aside about, because this has been a running theme that they have done in a couple of episodes and I think have done poorly generally, mostly in Rosa, we saw this, is the educational kind of thing. There's a point in the middle of this episode where they come upon the antimatter generation, like the particle accelerator that creates the antimatter that fuels the engines of the ship. It's like, great, fine. Star Trek, I'm good. Antimatter, we got it. It's real sciencey stuff. And then we proceed to have like a 5-minute sequence of the Doctor like explaining what antimatter is, but in the worst fucking way, because she keeps on going on about like positrons and it was like she says the word positron about 5 times, which a positron is a positively charged electron, basically. So it's like the mirror image of an electron. It's the antimatter version of an electron, which is, you know, one of the basic particles of life, or of like anything, electrons, which is fine. Like, that's real science, I guess. The problem is, if you're trying to explain the concept of antimatter to people that don't know what antimatter is, and you start throwing in jargon like positron, in a way that also sounds like Chris Chibnall doesn't really know that much about it, because it's just kind of clumsy, all it does is confuse everybody. And it's like, you can't... It's so pointless. Why throw around the terminology in this show where you're going to talk about it for 5 fucking minutes? If you want to try to teach people something about antimatter, one, make the episode more about that. Two, deal with it in the broad concept of what antimatter is, not in this weird nitty-gritty way about particle accelerators and bullshit. And it's like a great example of an episode that did sciencey stuff and felt like it taught people that didn't know it, taught to them something about it, but it in a way that didn't interrupt anything, was in the second to last episode of season 10, where the Doctor's explaining like the relativity of gravity,
yes,
and time in relationship to time, and that great sequence where, you know, it's like, you know, actually playing with the time dilation as he's explaining what time dilation is because of the black hole. And it's like, that's a great little thing. It's like the whole episode is about that time dilation. The Doctor explains what that time dilation is from a big picture perspective that like a 10-year-old would be able to understand. And this, there's something about the way she explained the antimatter particle accelerator stuff really annoyed me, because it felt like it was trying to like posture as being educational without actually taking the time to consider how would you teach this science concept. And it felt clumsy in the way that like the Wikipedia summary shit from Rosa felt very clumsy to me.
Yes,
there
is clearly one of the notes on like Chris Chibnall's vision board for this season is like, be educational again. But I don't think he has any sense of how Doctor Who has been educational in the past. And also, if you're doing that, you're implicitly aiming it at kids, which is fine. Doctor Who's origins are as a kids' show, and frequently it is past that, too. But if you're going to have the show be for kids, like, this is not a kid-friendly season. Like, the tone is so all over the map. The visuals are not pitched in that direction. Other than these pockets of educational moments, it doesn't feel like it's trying that. Like, you know, one of the reasons I like the episode In the Forest of the Night from Series 8 is they did kind of a kid-friendly Doctor Who episode, and it's fun, and you get to have Peter Capaldi, like, interact with all the children, and I feel like they did it from, like, a kid-level view. But they're not attempting anything like that. So it's just bizarre, and I don't know. At least that was a... I know we disagree on that episode in The Forest of the Night, but we can both agree it's a concerted effort to do it. Like, that's not here.
Yes. So, yeah, that's that little dumb thing. But then, something that is not dumb, and is actually by far my biggest problem, and it's something we addressed a little bit earlier, is the sort of visual logic of this episode. Not in a sense of that it's like, you know, doing confusing things like cutting away from Yaz and cutting back to Yaz like in the first episode and that kind of stuff. But there's just little moments where it feels like they don't communicate the plot of the episode in a visual way, particularly for the A plot and the shit with the monster, in a way that made any sense to me. And I had to go back and rewatch about 5 to 10 minutes of this episode in like select chunks to understand what the fuck happened, partially because of how poorly like constructed in a visual sense a lot of this is. One of the major issues is that outside of the initial establishing shot, there are no shots of the ship itself. Mm-hmm. And so everything else is on the ship. And a whole part of the tension about this episode is, can we get to the platform or wherever we're trying to go? I don't know where we're trying to go because you never fucking cut to it either. So it's like, I don't know where we're going. I don't know how fast we're going. I don't know anything about our spatial relationship in regards to our destination. But we're trying to fly the ship somewhere. And you never see a shot of the ship fucking moving. And it makes it really hard to understand, what is the tension in the scene? What is our objective? Where are we trying to go? There's a sense of you're trying to get to some sort of like space station or platform or something, but that space station or platform is going to kill us if we don't do something and send a signal. But again, like, you need to show the ship moving. You need to cut to a shot of like people in this, wherever they're going to, being like, we have some strange reading on the radar. Should we blow it up or do whatever? And then being like, well, let's check it out. And like, wait for a second or something and build up tension that way. You know, the way that any other movie or TV show or anything has ever tried to do this thing has done this thing. There's a reason why they do it that way, because it doesn't make any fucking sense. And I just didn't know what was happening because of that. There's another moment then, kind of wrapped up in all that, where the doctor does the cliche, like, you're a genius. Energy. It's trying to eat energy. And it's the most confusing fucking thing. I had to watch it back like 3 times to figure out, when does she have this idea? Because it's when the guy is setting up his sister to have the ship, and he says something offhandedly about like, we'll need this much energy to get this thing to work, blah, 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 blah. And then it cuts to the doctor on the other side of the room doing her own thing, wiring up the signal or whatever the fuck she's doing, and does that whole thing for like 30 seconds or something. Then she stands up and she walks over, looks at the guy, and then she just goes, you're a genius. Energy. This monster just wants to eat energy. Which is also like the revelation that it wants to eat energy is not something that is surprising. It's not set up in any way. It's just like okay, that makes sense. Everything eats matter to get energy. I guess it just eats energy. Whatever eating energy means, I don't know. The episode's not that scientifically literate, but okay. Sure. But that whole gag in the whole setup was so confusing that the first time I watched it, I literally didn't understand what the fuck was happening. So that's a big problem. Another smaller one I have down here is the scene where the monster eats the screwdriver. It's just like really amateurishly done, and they don't have a shot of the monster actually swallowing the screwdriver. But they also don't spend enough time in a reverse shot of Jodie Whittaker pretending to have it be eaten. And so that whole bit just looked bad to me.
Can I pause on this for a second?
Yes.
The screwdriver. This is such a minor issue compared to everything else this season, but we are firmly back in Doctor Who way the hell over relying on the sonic screwdriver territory, which we mostly got away from in the Capaldi years. We are now back to like the worst of like the David Tennant, Matt Smith spinning it around and it being an omnipresent prop. So much so that this episode I was like, oh, they're going to have her, she's not going to have the sonic this episode. And then like 5 minutes later, she's like, oh, clever sonic, you repowered yourself. And I was just like,
yeah,
fuck you. You couldn't even pretend to, like, shake this up. It's so stupid.
Yeah, it is the most just, like, he realized, oh, shit, I had that whole thing where it swallowed the sonic and the sonic didn't work. Well, it just works now. Like, yeah it wasn't even a, like, oh, I have to plug it into the antimatter thing to get it to work again. It's just like, no, it just works. It's whatever. And this is my biggest problem with the whole episode, is everything to do with the fucking bomb. I don't know about you, Jonathan, but the first time I watched the episode, when she starts talking about a bomb, I'm like, What the fuck are you talking about? What bomb? Nobody, like, she, because she literally, I'll have to watch the whole episode again to be 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure the first time she mentions a bomb is she's walking into the room where Yaz and the android are, and she just mutters to herself, a bomb. And it's just like, what bomb? What are you talking about? Did you understand that?
No, I didn't. I was tuning. You're thinking about all of this so much more than I did. I tuned out the last half of this episode mostly. I was just kind of watching the flashing lights and just kind of like, okay. And when they talked technobabble, I tuned it out. So, because it was nonsensical.
So let me explain this to you, Jonathan, because I was so frustrated and annoyed by this that I went back to rewatch these scenes to try to figure out what the fuck was going on. So it seems to me that what's happening is the ship is trying to get to some destination, and that destination is going to destroy the ship if it doesn't send like a like safety signal or whatever, a fail-safe signal, and they will destroy the ship because they'll be afraid it's like, you know, an epidemic or something on there and they need to quarantine it. It's like, fair enough. But when they first explain that, they imply that the ship's, that the station is going to blow up the ship with like missiles or a laser or something like that. That's all established, like, earlier on in the episode. And then once you get near the end, with, again, with no attention paid, no visual emphasis, nothing, and this is where, like, the visual language of this episode is just completely lacking and feels like they didn't have the coverage or something, although half the coverage that they would have need feels like they are effects shots, so maybe they just ran out of budget.
Yeah.
I don't fucking know. But it's... What has happened is instead of firing missiles, apparently they're afraid that the ships would be too far away if there's this weird, like, epidemic scenario. So instead they have planted a bomb inside the ships that are underneath the antimatter generator that will explode if they get too close and the safety signal isn't still going. I guess I don't think they get that detailed with it. And so the doctor just realizes this apropos of literally... fucking nothing. And this is like the moment where it's like, why I didn't understand what was even happening is she just walks into the room where Yaz and the android are with the particle accelerator and just says, there's a bomb in here. And they're like, a bomb? And it's like, it's underneath this thing. It is here as a failsafe so that they can blow up the ship. And it's like, and again, you don't see the moment where she realizes anything about the bomb. You only see the moment where she realizes the thing can eat energy. And so... you missed the whole, like, actual important part of that revelation. Because it's like, we know the thing eats all this shit. We kind of know it already sucks out energy. The important part of this revelation is that they're not going to shoot missiles. There's already a bomb on the ship that is ticking down. It's like, how do you mess up the reveal of a ticking bomb? It's literally, like, the oldest trick in fucking cinema. Yes. So it's like, it's so ridiculous. And it's also just completely unnecessary because you have antimatter generation on the ship anyways, like antimatter, you know, obliteration with normal matter being obviously catastrophic and generating tremendous quantities of energy, which is exactly literally the point of having an antimatter engine on your ship, is because it makes a lot of energy so your ship can go real fast. So if the monster eats energy, why isn't it just eating the fucking engine where it's making the antimatter, which you could also rig up to be the lure so it'll eat the antimatter in the thing? It's like, why does the bomb even exist at all? Especially if you're not going to explain in a sufficient capacity why it is even on the ship. It's like so basically incompetent plotting and just like visual storytelling. It's just on a different level than a lot of the other stuff I've seen in this season of Doctor Who and in any season of Doctor Who. And it's just like, how did this get out the door that way? How did nobody watch this and be like, Chris, what the fuck are you talking about with this bomb? It's the most pulled out of your ass plot point. Like, it's like almost beyond like the reset button in Journey to the Center of the TARDIS. At least the reset button in Journey to the Center of the TARDIS came through in the fucking time thing at the beginning of the episode. It's a dumb plot point. But it's set up in the first shot of the fucking episode. In this, the bomb exists for no reason, is not set up, and it's just an entire Deus Ex Machina plot device that didn't even need to exist. It's like, what are you even doing? It pisses me off.
All right. For all these reasons and more, Sean, I want to ask you a question. We are now halfway through the season. We are potentially 1/6 of the way through the 13th Doctor's run, as I've said before. We are through the initial Chris Chibnall grip of death on the show through these first 5 episodes. We will have a different writer next week, although, again, I would caution people, it's still Chris Chibnall's show. This writer will still have to deal with all 4 characters and having no relationships between them and all the other problems that are kind of baked in at this point. So I'm curious, but I'm not enthusiastic. Has there been a showrunner / script editor producer more seemingly incompetent at just the Doctor Who basics at any point in the show's history? Because that's the thing that strikes me here, is that there have been other dark periods, like the Sixth Doctor or something. But I would say, like, Eric Sayward is an obviously manifestly good Doctor Who writer, right? Like,
yes,
John
yeah.
Nathan Turner
been...
had problems, but also, I think, understood the show. Like, this is different.
Yeah, like, I certainly don't think that there has been a script editor that has been this bad. And again, if you want details on, like, how that stuff worked for old Doctor Who, because there's no showrunner thing. We did a whole podcast dealing with that with classic Doctor Who. But yeah, the duties that we understand as the showrunner duties now were basically shared between 2 people, the script editor and, the lead producer back in the day. And yeah, I don't think... Like, I think you can make an argument about John Nathan Turner because he... But, like, it's not just him. Like, it's so much about the scenario he was in. Like, we don't know what John Nathan Turner would have been like in a, like, perfect world where the BBC was backing Doctor Who fully, because the BBC had been against Doctor Who since, like, Hinchcliffe left, and they kind of forced Hinchcliffe out. So that is not a particularly fair comparison, but, like, you know, John Nathan Turner made some pretty significant mistakes in his tenure on the show. But he had way more shit to have to deal with. And I think that a lot of the changes he made were interesting, even if they weren't as successful. And he certainly balanced the fucking multiple companion things better than this. Like, and that's saying something. Because, you know, Nyssa, Tegan, and Adric is not a great fucking set of characters to deal with. But I would take all 3 of those any day over what we have here, because at least, you know, I don't like Tegan or Adric, and I think they're bad characters, but I can kind of more say they're characters. And, like, you know, again, Tegan is this, like, wet towel that, like, hates being on these adventures and just wants to go home and wants to go back to Heathrow Airport. Adric is this bratty, annoying little math genius. And then Nyssa is this very, like, sort of, like, calm and centered princess that is kind of out to see the universe with the Doctor, who has this trauma about all the shit that happened on her own world with the Master killing her dad. Killing her dad, I mean, taking over her dad's body in possession.
That is traumatic. That'd be really hard.
Yeah, that'd be really hard to deal with. So it's like, those are all actual legitimate characters that have character traits that, again, the balance is off in basically every single Fifth Doctor story between those 3 characters. Like, Tegan is very annoying. Adric is very annoying. I don't think the performances are as good, other than maybe Sarah Sutton as Nyssa, I think, is pretty good. But they're not as good as the acting, average level of acting. And these have been for, like, it's just, like, a very abstracted sense. But yeah, like, I think that they handled that element better then. And that's not good.
No.
That's really not good.
I guess why I'm asking this is on one level we can say it's only 5 episodes, give it time. But on the other hand, I say that's half a season. And it's potentially a 1/6 of this Doctor's run if she does what every other Doctor in the modern run has done and does 3 seasons, you know? Like, and it's also 5 in a row by the showrunner. 4.5, you know, however you want to count Rosa, which is half Chris Chibnall. So it's like, this is a very concentrated block of what his vision for the show is. There seems to be no vision. It's the most sustained incompetence I think I've ever seen on just what the basics of Doctor Who is. And that's what worries me, because I think you can say it's only 5 episodes, but I would say I think we're in uncharted territory. I don't think we've ever had a scenario where, like, we're going into 4 episodes by other people, but we've never been in a period on Doctor Who where other people have written and the script editor didn't know how to write the show. That's my point.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there are good RTD episodes and bad RTD episodes, but RTD knew how to write the show and he could shepherd another person writing for the show. You know, like, you sense that, like, this guy has a sensor for what's going to come into the show. Same with Moffat, Same in the past with, you know, whoever you want to name, Robert Holmes, Eric Sayward, Douglas Adams in his one season, whatever. Like, and they all have different ups and downs, except Robert Holmes, who's all ups.
Yes.
And
all ups all the
time. But it's like, this is just eek. It is to me, kind of uncharted territory. Like, this is so much more. I was expecting we would get a little drop off as the show went through some creative growing pains. This was not in, like, the tail of the possibilities I was thinking of going into this season. I speaking for me, I don't know about you, Sean.
Yeah, like, I think there's a part of me that, like, you know, Power of Three, it's not a great episode. Like, I'm way more down on the dinosaurs on a spaceship than you are, because you, as I recall, generally really
like that episode. There has not been an episode this season as good as Dinosaurs on a Spaceship.
Yeah, that's definitely fucking true. Because again, you had at least Amy and Rory and Rory's dad, mm-hmm. you know, and so it's like you cared about Rory, and so you cared about Rory's dad, and you cared about Amy.
Rory's dad was created by Chris Chibnall. That's the episode he's introduced in. He only appeared in the two episodes written by Chris Chibnall that season, that and Power of Three. That is a better character than he has created in his tenure as showrunner.
But and part of that feels like he had this platform to build off of. And so it's like it's much easier to make a really great supporting character to a really great cast that had been around for two full seasons at mm-hmm. that point, going into their third season. Like, he had such a incredible foundation that Moffat had made between the Doctor, Amy, and Rory. And he did a good job with those character bits in those episodes. Like, the Power of Three, most of the Power of Three is very enjoyable, and I love Matt Smith in that episode. And he has all that fun stuff that he gets to do on Earth, and like playing the Wii and painting a fence and like, you know, like playing around with the soccer ball and all that. Like, I love the Doctor just having to live in casual Earth in that story. But it's all the stuff around it that doesn't work, and it's like when the plot has to happen, it falls apart. And it's kind of what this has felt like. And because he's the only person that can make the plot happen, he doesn't have the space to do any of the stuff that was fun in the episodes that he was better at and that were more fun. And so, yeah, for this, like, this is, like, the darkest possibility of, like, all the worst parts of the Chris Chibnall-pinned episodes from the previous seasons feel like that's what we are seeing in all these episodes, because it just feels like he's, as you said, he's not a, like, basically functional Doctor Who writer. Like, not even Mark Gatiss level. Like, Mark Gatiss, for all his
issues, miss Mark Gatiss right now.
He could make a, like, basically competent episode of Doctor Who. And that was, like, the worst thing you could say about it. It was like, that's an episode of Doctor Who you made.
Empress of Mars is better than any of these five episodes.
Yeah. Like, I would fucking take 100... Okay, maybe 100's a lot. But I would take 10 more Sleep No Mores than this, you know? I certainly would take... I'd take 100 of those Robin Hood episodes. That one was really good. Then, yeah. It's a dark scenario that we're in right now with Chris Chibnall. That is not what I was anticipating. I was anticipating, I think, like I've said, every one of these, a more significant change in the status quo of the show. Instead of what we have gotten is that, like, we have changed the style, but we have not changed the substance, which is particularly troubling when you have changed such a fundamental element of what the structure of the show was as having four full main characters. It's like, you can't do the RTD Stephen Moffat model. You have to do, like, a bunch of two-parters, or you have to have a, like, much more serialized season of Doctor Who, which is not something I want Doctor Who to be all the time, but it could work. It would play more to Chibnall's strengths from Broadchurch.
Yeah. Does it also, you know, feel weird, like, that, like, halfway through, there's not even, other than a little bit in the Ghost Monument, there's not even really a hint of an arc here?
Yeah, I think the biggest issue is that there's a hint of it in the second episode, and so it's like, that's what the last episode is going to be. I can basically guarantee the Stins are going to come back, or they would have never referenced it in episode 2. But by the time we get to episode 10, since there are no two-parters, it's going to be episode 10. If there are no more references to that shit between now and then, that's crazy. Because I will only remember that shit because I'm a Doctor Who idiot and we do this podcast.
But there's...
The vast majority of the people watching the show will have completely forgotten everything about Toothpaste Man if you don't keep on shoving it in their faces. It's why RTD and Moffat had to do, like, a dumb little scene every episode, is because most people watching week to week will have completely forgotten next week that you did
And I don't even just mean plot arcing, like, character arcing. Like, I don't feel any growth these fights. Like, it's just, these are just kind of five episodes of Doctor Who. Even Classic Who, which generally elided serialization outside of serials, I know it's a weird way to say it, like, you know, I don't know, by the end of the fourth Doctor's first season, and again, it's an all-time great season, but it's a good one to go to, the Doctor, Sarah, and third guy, what was his name?
Ian?
Is it Ian?
Is that Ian?
No.
No, but not Chesterton. Fucking, what's the... It's the...
Ian Martyr is the actor, so I don't... Yes. The guy played by Ian Martyr. I like that character. But like, by the end of that, I got a real sense of who these three characters were and what relationships they'd grown, and I feel like a journey was gone on. You don't get that in these five episodes. There's no... Harry. It's Harry. I just remembered.
Yes, Harry Sullivan. Harry Sullivan. That's right. Yeah.
All right. I remembered a classic Doctor Who fact off the top of my head when you couldn't. That might be a first.
Yeah. You hit me with a hard one. I haven't watched any Harry episodes in a while, and
yes,
have.
No, it's okay. It's more fresh for me. I have the Blu-rays sitting on my desk right now. But anyway, yeah. So we can wrap it up here. I think we're in a dark timeline with Doctor Who right now. I'm curious where it goes, but that's where we've been for a while. Next week on the show, we will continue talking about stuff. I'm not sure what stuff. That's the last episode before Thanksgiving, and then I will be back in Colorado, so the next episode after that will probably be one we just do in person.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, maybe we'll do a Dragon Quest talk for that. That might be a fun Thanksgiving topic.
Yes, yeah, we need to do that while I still remember Dragon Quest, because my brain is being taken over by Red Dead Redemption 2.
I will never forget it. It's in my heart. It's right here. I carry it with me every day. All right, so let's wrap it up for today. Sean, any closing thoughts?
Fucking Doctor Who, man. It's do or die from this point on. We're getting some not Chris Chibnall episodes. If those are bad, uh-oh.